him. You'll hear from the president. Meanwhile,
our long-term national interest requires closer partnership with our allies in Europe.
Keir Starmer now wants a much closer relationship with Europe, saying Brexit did huge damage to the economy as European countries meet to discuss the Hormuz. Should we get back into the EU? And
I don't think that this dispute is resolved by headline generation, and I don't think that it's resolved by making threats.
Resident doctors choose to go on strike again. Your chance to question the BMA later. Are they holding the NHS to ransom?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 7 o'clock, NASA's first crewed mission to the moon in more than 50 years has blasted off from Florida. Artemis 2 is due to take the crew further into space than anyone has gone before. The mission won't land on the moon but will pass its far side, hopefully paving the way for a lunar landing in 2 years' time. Crowds packed roads and beaches near Cape Canaveral to watch the launch.
It was amazing. I absolutely loved hearing everybody cheer when it was going up. That was pretty cool. There were so many people here.
I cried the whole time.
It was so cool. It was really fast, though.
A universal event. Not just a historic, but a universal event.
President Trump says the United States is getting very close to completing its military objectives in Iran. In a televised address overnight, he said America would subject the country to another 2 to 3 weeks of extremely hard strikes.
We're going to bring them back to the Stone Ages where they belong. In the meantime, discussions are ongoing. Regime change was not our goal. We never said regime change, but regime change has occurred because of all of their original leaders' death. They're all dead.
Mr. Trump said despite negotiations continuing, the U.S. military is still prepared to bomb the country's power plants if necessary. The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, will host a virtual meeting of international leaders later to discuss diplomatic measures to try and reopen the Strait of Hormuz. After Donald Trump's speech, oil prices rose by about 5% to $105 a barrel. The motoring group, the RAC, has also reported record monthly increases in fuel prices in March because of the conflict. Average petrol prices surged by 20p a litre, while diesel was 40 pence higher. The government has withdrawn an offer to create 1,000 extra training places for resident doctors in England. Sir Keir Starmer had given the doctors' union, the BMA, a deadline of 48 hours to call off next week's strikes or face losing the posts. And new rules to make it easier to cancel subscriptions have been announced by the government. Customers will be given a 14-day cooling-off period after the end of a trial period or when an annual contract renews automatically. The changes will come in early next year. Ministers say the move could save people around £170 a year. In the city, the FTSE 100 will reopen later at 10,364. It closed up 188 yesterday. The pound buys $1.33 and €1.14. LBC weather, a sunny start for many, but turning cloudy later. Some heavy rain for Northern Ireland and the west of Scotland by the afternoon. A high of 13 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Hey Sainsbury's, I'm cooking for everyone this Easter, but I don't want to break the bank. Got any tasty offers?
Well, with Nectar, there's half price on selected sides of salmon. And selected beef joints and whole legs of lamb are better than half price.
Ooh, they'll be as happy as my wallet.
Sainsbury's, good food for all of us. 18 plus, Nectar required, excludes locals, ends 7th of April, subject to availability. T's and C's apply.
Is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation. Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick.
Morning to you. 3 minutes past seven on Thursday, the 2nd of April. Tom Swarbrick in for Nick Ferrari at breakfast here on LBC. Hope we find you well. Coming up,
the most effective way we can support the cost of living in Britain is to push for de-escalation in the Middle East.
EU and whose army? UK and Europeans meet about how to get the Hormuz open. Keir Starmer saying we need a much closer relationship with the EU now that Brexit did huge damage to the economy. Is he wrong? Also,
hold on. Is this... Look at this...
Oh, look at... parenting lessons from the police after viral link-ups turn violent in Clapham with hundreds of teenagers involved, the Met tell parents to get a grip. Is this down to a lack of parenting? Talking of getting a rocket...
3, 2, 1, booster ignition, and liftoff. The crew of Artemis II now bound for the moon. Humanity's next great voyage begins.
Last off for Artemis II, astronauts on a 10-day mission to the moon, or at least close to the moon, a launch report to come. Plus...
I'm very willing and I'm ready to negotiate whenever the government would like to.
The resident doctors have chosen to strike again, another 7 days next week. The government is livid. Your chance to question the head of the BMA union later in the show.
Call 0345 60 60 973. Tweet at LBC. Text 84850. Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
Very good morning to you. This hour...
There's never been anything like it militarily. Everyone is talking about it. And tonight I'm pleased to say that these core strategic objectives are nearing completion.
The war in Iran is nearly complete, the president said to a sceptical nation a few hours ago, trying to persuade them that the war was worth it, that gas prices will come down and that Iran no longer poses an imminent nuclear threat. Not that he has laid out the evidence yet to show that it did. This isn't Vietnam, the president was keen to stress, as he once again had a pop at the UK for not getting involved. Here's a little of President Trump saying the war's nearly over.
As we speak this evening, it's been just 1 month since the United States military began Operation Epic Fury, targeting the world's number one state sponsor of terror, Iran. In these past 4 weeks, our armed forces have delivered swift, decisive, overwhelming victories on the battlefield. Victories like few people have ever seen before. Tonight, Iran's navy is gone. Their air force is in ruins. Their leaders, most of them, terrorist regime they led, are now dead. Their command and control of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps is being decimated as we speak. Their ability to launch missiles and drones is dramatically curtailed, and their weapons, factories, and rocket launchers are being blown to pieces. Very few of them left. Never in the history of warfare has an enemy suffered such clear and devastating large-scale losses in a matter of weeks. Our enemies are losing in America, as it has been for 5 years under my presidency, is winning, and now winning bigger than ever before.
I mean, he sounds flat as anything, doesn't he? It's nearly over, but we're going to hit them over the coming weeks. The guy, frankly, doesn't have a plan. That the Hormuz will just reopen and it will all be plain sailing is a policy based on a vibe, I think. The Telegraph, who have spoken to the president recently in an interview where he said he was seriously considering pulling the US out of NATO, now quotes the president's latest attack on Keir Starmer. Trump has said that he believes that the king would have stood by him over the war in Iran. I like him, said Trump of the king. I always liked him as a prince. He's a good man, a great representative of your country. Mr. Trump said when asked about the king's upcoming state visit to the UK, I think he would have taken a very different stand on the war with Iran, but he doesn't do that. I mean, he's a great gentleman. Folks, the delusion is at record levels now. They've never seen presidential delusion like this before. Mark Armand is a historian, columnist and director of the Crisis Research Institute in Oxford. Thanks very much indeed for coming on the programme, Mark. I wonder what you took from the president's rambling address.
Well, that despite his boasts about the huge costs inflicted on Iran, which is probably true, he doesn't really have any way of ending the war. And it's rather odd that he even chose to make this address.
Yes.
And of course, a few hours before this, a long conversation in the White House with journalists and members of his staff was accidentally released by the White House press officials, which again revealed that he essentially says, it's up to other people to solve the problems that my attack on Iran has created. He insists that he has once again obliterated Iran's capacity to make nuclear weapons at any point in the reasonably near future. But he hasn't explained why the Iranians themselves, the Iranian regime, the Iranian military should give in. And on the contrary, in a sense, gives them very little alternative, because there's no prospect of benefits for the Iranian regime of stopping the war. On the contrary, he insists that they'll be bombed back to the Stone Age unless they give in. But of course, they may say, well, what alternative do we have? The Revolutionary Guards and so on, we probably would be killed if we were to surrender.
And give in what sense? Give in that they all just sort of disappear and a new person, whoever that might be, is brought in? What does that mean, to give in, really?
Well, yes, I mean, this is the problem. See, often Trump looks back to the Second World War, and he mentioned the comparisons with the Second World War. But although the Americans and British and so on inflicted huge harm with bombardments of Germany, and the Americans, in the case of Japan, also with nuclear weapons, they also offered inducements. They sent in military engineers to restore the water supply, to get the telephones working again. There were huge provisions of medical aid, and very quickly, life got better. People could see that losing was actually not the end. What, in this case, when you say several times during the last 24 hours or so that you will bomb Iran back to the Stone Age, suggests that you don't really have any offer. You know, Trump is supposed to be the master of the art of the deal. Surely you give to the other side reasons to think that they're going to benefit.
Mm.
Whereas it might be a relief to many ordinary Iranians if the war just stopped, if the bombing just stopped. But, of course, they're not in charge. The Islamic Republic's guardians are in charge. And for them, you need to find some way of saying that defeat, accepting defeat, making some kind of peace, is preferable to carrying on. And there's no inducement here.
It was interesting to hear the president try and tell a nation, the United States, that isn't for this war in the main, that don't worry, this isn't Vietnam, and then suggest that to one newspaper this morning that the king would have supported him on it.
Yeah, I also don't think he understands the British Constitution and the monarchs.
You surprise me, Mark.
Well, the other problem is, the question is, does he understand the US Constitution? For instance, the power to make war is actually vested in the Congress. The president, as commander-in-chief and the person who directs foreign policy, can react to crises, can deploy force in response to a crisis. But in this case, he's initiated a war, and he's also now, as you were mentioning earlier, threatening to leave NATO. Now, the Congress under Biden, just before Trump returned to office, passed a law that says that the president cannot arbitrarily withdraw the United States from alliances and from treaties. The problem, of course, is, as Trump has shown, he can say, OK, I can't withdraw from NATO, but I can simply stop cooperating with it. I can, in effect, say to anybody, Putin, for instance, that Article 5 will not be activated by the United States.
Mark, really appreciate your time. Thank you for coming on. Mark Armand is a historian, columnist and director of the Crisis Research Institute in Oxford. Dr. Laura Smith joins us, presidential historian at the University of Oxford. Thank you very much indeed for coming on, Dr. Smith. Where does this presidential address to the nation rank then? What was the point of it, do you think?
I think a lot of people are scratching their heads and wondering that right now. I think the point of it was clearly, as you said, the fact that he wasn't very enthusiastic, as he never really is if he doesn't have an audience right in front of him cheering him on, is he feels really forced into this, this idea that he felt this pressure, the fact that this war has become so unpopular, and the fact that it's a spate of short a month, in fact that he's saying, oh, well, you know, clearly we've done so well, even though there's still more to do, apparently. Even though, you know, we've clearly won, as he says, and yet he felt compelled to have to come and justify it to the American public. So I think he really felt forced, which is why, as you said, he fell so flat. Mm. And in fact, if it was Joe Biden who had been in his position trying to do this sort of speech, he would have said that he was, you know, sleepy Joe Biden. This was a sleepy speech from Donald Trump, in some way showing his own age. And so this really wasn't very enthusiastic. It wasn't very compelling. As always, it was short on policy details.
Yeah.
So it's doubtful to really sway anyone here.
History might tell us that President Trump seems to move on to the next thing when he feels bored by the thing in front of him. Do you think that there is a risk that he gets quite bored of and scared of the reaction to, in the United States in particular, this war with Iran?
I think the concern more is, in terms of fear of reaction, for him, what is the fear? Because he's not on the ballot anymore. And certainly with the midterms, it's not his to have be concerned about anymore, because they're not voting for him personally. Mm-hmm. So in terms of, you know, the sort of fear of party members saying, you know, sir, I'm on the ballot, I think that's more of a concern. You know, my colleague before me made the excellent sort of point about raising that point about World War II. Roosevelt was someone who was very clever and really focused on polling, but he was very much in communication, concerned about meeting the American people where they were and trying to explain his decisions through that and sort of guiding them like that. Donald Trump doesn't do that. So there are definitely lessons to be learned here in terms of communication, but he may not be interested in doing that.
Really appreciate your time. Thank you for coming on. Dr. Laura Smith is presidential historian at the University of Oxford. So, President Trump addressing the nation. There was some speculation before that he was going to say, quotes, mission accomplished, that's the end. He didn't go that far. He said, well, we're nearly there, but over the coming weeks we could bomb them to oblivion. We've achieved lots of our aims, including stopping them having a nuclear weapon. Not that that was ever detailed as being a reality that needed to be addressed, certainly in the short term. And then we have the suggestion from the president that, well, Keir Starmer might not have backed me, but the king definitely would have done. You see the peril that this visit to the US is now fraught with for His Majesty the King, don't you? What is he going to say when Trump says, oh, you'd have backed me, wouldn't you, Your Majesty? You'd have gone for it. What do you want him to say there? Absolutely not. Because I think the majority of people here, whether it's taken them longer than others, have come to the realisation, and you can only be left with this impression from listening to the president, there's no plan to get out of this. There's no exit plan that leaves the world in a better position than it was prior to this war beginning. He could walk away with the trading route we are pretty reliant upon still closed, and the UK and European countries scratching their head wondering whether we're going to have to pay the Iranians to get some tankers out. 03456060973. Did that sound to you like a president in control? Meanwhile,
when people are filling up their cars, you know, they will be looking at the price per litre. We're going to stand by the British people through this crisis.
You can't help but have noticed at least one of the effects from this war with Iran. Drivers endured record monthly increases in fuel prices in March. The AA says it's simple. Cut your speed. Is that something that you're already doing? We'll speak to the AA in a few moments. Tom Swarbrick here on LBC. 7:16 news headlines now. Dominic Ellis.
For the first time in more than 50 years, a rocket-carrying astronaut is on its way to the moon. President Trump says the US is on track to complete all of its objectives in the war in Iran very shortly. And the government has confirmed it is withdrawing its offer to create 1,000 extra training places for resident doctors in England. LBC weather, a sunny start for many, but gradually clouding over. Heavy rain for Northern Ireland and the west of Scotland. Later, a high of 13 degrees.
LBC Travel, I'm Joanne Webb. The M23 is closed northbound between junctions 10 at Crawley and 9 at Gatwick Airport. It's all down to an accident and there are lengthy queues on the approach. If you're heading that way to Gatwick Airport, do allow yourself a lot of extra time. Also, the A40 remains closed both ways between the Marylebone Flyover and the Northern Roundabout because of the ongoing bridge works. On the Underground, the Piccadilly line remains suspended between Acton Town and Rayners Lane. Also on the Underground, there are severe delays on the District line and minor on the Victoria line. And on the trains, Southern are delayed by about 20 minutes between Redhill and Tunbridge, and Greater Anglia services are delayed to and from Liverpool Street to both Cheshunt and Shenfield after an investigation.
LBC.
Oh, Fiona's back at the Monkey Safari again. She's hooked on Toyota Service and Aftercare. In fact, it's so good, she'll find any excuse to come back. From replacement wipers to service and MOTs, our perks include free refreshments, quiet workspaces, courtesy cars, and a new warranty with every eligible service. Toyota Service and Aftercare. So good, you'll find any excuse to come back. Eligible services are available until the vehicle turns 10 years old or 100,000 miles. T's and C's apply.
This is LBC.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. What would you like from your investing app? 6% interest on your ISA, a free share of your choice, or no commission on stocks and ETFs up to 100,000 euros per month? With XTB, you get all of the above all in one app, the XTB app. Get your free share and start investing with XTB today. XTB, where your money works.
Capital at risk. Investment values can rise or fall. Limited free stock availability. 2% ISA rate boost for 90 days. New clients only. T's and C's apply.
Here's a tale of two commuters. Steve was in a rush and needed to park near the station. Jane also needed a space and booked in advance with Your Parking Space. Steve had a meeting at 9 and panic at 8. Nowhere to park. Jane, she's already in the office and enjoying that morning latte. With Your Parking Space, you can browse thousands of spaces across London and reserve the perfect one instantly. Get £10 off your first booking. Download the Your Parking Space app today.
Experience. It's knowing the difference between a good deal and, well, a great deal. That's why right now you can get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance. You get 24/7 GP access whenever you want it. And the freedom to choose your preferred private hospital with your own room should you need it. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
Morning to you, 20 past 7 the time. Tom Swarbrick here on LBC. I'm sure you won't have seen it because you've been tucked up sleeping nicely, but the President of the United States has addressed the nation at about 2 o'clock this morning, our time. And as is becoming the way, I'm afraid, we're almost at the stage of just having to ignore it. He hasn't really said anything new. He hasn't said it's mission accomplished. He said we're going to carry on. Don't worry, the Hormuz will open up. It'll all be fine. The gas and oil will get through. The hard bit's done. Europe should have joined me. It's not Vietnam, America. Don't worry. We've only been doing it for 32 days. And that's it. And you can see why, even when the President of the United States is threatening to withdraw from NATO, seriously considering withdrawing from NATO, you can perhaps see why I think Keir Starmer described it yesterday as noise. It's verbiage. It's just words. Of course, what the president does has to be taken very seriously. But what he says? Here's Nikki. Tom, I have to say I'm usually a fan of yours, but I find your rhetoric completely mind-blowing this morning. No one seems to be acknowledging the point of this war. I will personally sleep better in my bed knowing that Iran doesn't have the ability to launch terror on the world anymore. They have clearly proven over the last month they had a huge number of weapons at their disposal. They've launched those across the Middle East at their neighbours, at us, and everyone they could reach. And in a few years' time, I guarantee that they would have had the ability to reach Europe. So I don't understand all this blatant Trump bashing over a few extra quid at the pump when he's potentially saved hundreds of thousands, if not millions, says Nikki. Agree? Tom's in Winchester. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Tom. You okay?
I'm well, sir. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I just want to give some thoughts about the president's speech. I think so he's just losing the plot now, just playing like mind games where he said like the Starmer might not have agreed with me, but you know, the king would have done what I really want. But just think so he's just losing the plot. He just thought the war was just going to last like a couple of days or like weeks, but just going on for, I think so, for over a month now. And the fuel prices in the UK just, you know, hitting skyrocket now. I'm one of those people who have really been affected because I travel 80 miles every day to work. So obviously, I used to fill my tank every Sunday for like 50 quid. Now it's gone up to £70. So I'm just paying £80 a month from my pocket. So yeah, just really worried.
Will you, Tom, sleep sounder in your bed as Nikki will, knowing that Iran cannot, or its weapons program has been so degraded that any chance of it getting a weapon that could have hit us is now gone, we're told?
No, I don't think so. No.
Why? Because, that in theory, that's a good thing, isn't it? The people that have said that they want death to us, death to America, death to Israel, they can no longer bring about that cause of death, we're told.
Yeah, well, I kind of agree, but I just think so. Like, you know, Iran will still be able to do something about it because the war will never stop. I don't think so it will stop. So even if we have a ceasefire and the Strait of Hormuz is open, I think so they will still do something about it. They will probably still keep, you know, making more weapons because, they just now realize what America and Israel can do. And obviously, Trump probably have realized as well. It's not like easy to, you know, put Iran into another Afghanistan. Yeah. So I think so.
The question that the Americans, certainly the Trump administration, want people to answer in a particular way is, did this war need to happen? And the American president would say, yes, it did, because of the threat posed by Iran.
No, I think so. I think so. Even the Americans are now just turning their back against Trump now, because the inflation is like going high on a daily basis. So fuel prices are going high. Well, so I just think so. This war was really pointless. You know,
yeah.
Even if they want to build nuclear weapons, they'll probably try again. You know, they can get help from like Russia or China. So. I think so. This war shouldn't have happened.
Well, I do think it's a very good thing that Iran, certainly the people running Iran, don't have access to a nuclear weapon. I think that's a very, very good thing. That was being achieved, we're told, through diplomatic arrangements, the JCPOA and deals like that, which Trump pulled us out of. Is that fair to say then that in Trump's mind the war had to happen, even if it has effects like the one Tom is describing, like we're all feeling with the cost of petrol going up and the cost of food going up? Do you think it had to happen, this war? 03456060973. Tom, thank you very much indeed for the call. 7:24 next.
We're seeing Ireland, Greece, Hungary, Japan, Mexico, and even Germany and Austria, for example, are actually stopping the frequency of increase in pump prices.
To Tom's point, drivers endured record monthly increases in fuel prices in March amid the Iran oil crisis, according to new analysis. The RAC said the average price of a litre of petrol at UK forecourts rose by 20p from 132.8 to 152.8 on the last day of the month. Drivers of diesel vehicles, you will no doubt be aware, suffered an even bigger price hike, the average cost of a litre of fuel soaring by 40p from 142 to 182 over the same period. Edmund King is the president of the AA, who are calling for drivers to cut their speed. Edmund, morning to you. How much by, sir?
Yeah, morning, Tom. I mean, you know, as you say, prices are very, very high. Ironically, though, after the invasion of Ukraine in 2022, actually prices rose quicker there and rose to a higher amount. But that's not to say people aren't suffering at the moment. They certainly are. So one of the things that we've said to drivers, and of course, this is up to drivers, there's enough fuel out there, but it is costing a fortune. To fill up a tank of diesel now is about £100. And our analysis shows if you cut your speed by about 10%, so if you normally do 70 on a motorway, if you did 63, if you normally do 60 on a dual carriageway, if you did 54, in a 30 zone, if you did 27 miles an hour, that would save about 10% of your fuel. So that tank of diesel, you could save a tenner by adjusting your speed and your driving style. It's all about not braking too harshly, so leave a space from the car in front. And little things like checking your tire pressure. If you've got the correct tire pressures, you'll get more miles per gallon. You know, get rid of that heavy stuff in the boot. If you've got a roof rack that you're not using, all of those things, kind of common sense things, but it is a way that drivers can make their very expensive fuel just go that little bit further.
Strip it down, go slower, is the message from the AA.
Yeah, and drive more smoothly. It's all about your right foot. You know, you often see people kind of accelerating to the roundabout or to the traffic light where you have to stop.
Yeah.
And, you know, these are a lot of techniques that people who drive electric vehicles do anyway. You know, trying not to brake, you slow down gradually as you approach the junction, and that's safer driving anyway. Mm-hmm. And it saves you money. The other thing, Tom, that I found that if you've got a typical, I don't know, 1.5 litre petrol or diesel car, if you leave it idling, engine running, which you often see people mm-hmm. waiting outside shops and all of that. But a petrol engine idling for about an hour uses 0.5 litre of fuel. So, you know, even things like that, can you turn the engine off?
Well, at traffic lights?
Well, at traffic lights, many cars have stop-start, and it does that right. automatically. So I wouldn't say traffic lights.
So all these things that you could do in order to save yourself a bit of money here or there, Edmund, fantastic. But at what stage, how high is petrol going to get before you think the government needs to step in with some duty cuts?
Yeah, I mean, the next change in duty is due in September, where the government is due to increase duty by 1p a litre, then in December 2p a litre, and then next March 2p a litre. That's that 5p that was delayed. one thing we are saying to government, as a result of these prices at the pumps, they are actually getting more money in VAT. So fuel duty remains the same, 52.95p. But VAT is based on the price of fuel. And at the moment, VAT is about 27p a litre. So what we're saying to government, there is some free money there from the extra money you've got from VAT. And that could be given back either in duty cuts or at some stage looking at a VAT cut.
You said that we've got enough fuel. How long for?
Well, most of our fuel doesn't actually come from the Middle East. It comes from Norway, America, North Sea. So in terms of supply, it shouldn't be a problem. The problem is the price, because even though our fuel comes from elsewhere, prices, as you know, Tom, are set globally. It's based on, you know, Brent crude for us. And depending on what Trump says, we saw overnight, Brent crude's gone up
again.
Yes,
quite. Yeah, he hasn't had a dampening effect on that, has he?
Well, indeed. So it's so volatile, as it was with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But as quickly as things go up, they can also go down.
No chance, Edmund. Honestly, come on. The petrol prices are not going to fall as quickly as they have gone up during March. No chance.
Well, we did see with Ukraine, you know, there were about 3 month period with really excessive prices, higher than today. And then when things, well, I say settled down, it's still a war going on, but prices did come down. So some of this price is speculation on the futures market. You know, some of it is the 20% of fuel we're not getting through the Strait of Hormuz. But some of it is speculators speculating on the price of fuel going up.
And a lot of it are my listeners having to pay out for it, shell out for it constantly at a time when, as you say, there have been very, very large price rises in fuel, and it's coming again. Edmund, appreciate it. Edmund King is president of the AA. Slow down, folks. Cut your speed by 10%, they say, in order to save a bit of fuel. Get into the details of that as well. Tom Swarbrick here, coming up.
3, 2, 1, booster ignition. And lift off. The crew of Artemis 2 now bound for the moon. Humanity's next great voyage begins.
Wonder how much fuel that used. Artemis 2 has blasted off into space on a 10-day mission to the moon, or at least close to the moon. We'll get a launch report. 7:31. News headlines, Dominic Ellis.
NASA's first crewed mission to the moon in more than 50 years has blasted off from Cape Canaveral in Florida. Artemis 2 is due to take the crew further into space than anyone has gone before. President Trump says the United States is getting very close to completing its military objectives in Iran. In a televised address, he said America would subject the country to another 2 to 3 weeks of extremely hard strikes. And the government has withdrawn an offer to create 1,000 extra training places for resident doctors in England. Sir Keir Starmer had given the doctors' union, the BMA, a deadline of 48 hours to call off strikes next week or face losing the posts. LBC weather, a sunny start for many, but turning cloudy later. Some heavy rain for Northern Ireland and the west of Scotland. By the afternoon, a high of 13 degrees.
On the latest episode of The News Agents.
Trump is now saying he's considering pulling out of NATO. Has he finally had enough of the defense organization? And where does this leave the rest of Europe?
Get the latest episode of The News Agents with Emily Maitlis, John Sopel and Lewis Goodall. Listen or watch on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
This is 40-year-old Kathy, mother of two and self-confessed telly addict.
Oh, look at you. That's brilliant. Well done.
This is also Kathy, working as part of a team to keep things calm at her local prison.
Listen, speak to me.
And helping someone's son write his first letter home in 8 months.
Well done. You should be really proud.
Thank you, miss.
An extraordinary job done by someone like you. Search prison jobs now.
At AJ Bell, we believe investing is for everyone. And when we say everyone, we mean your dad, Dan, Danielle, Dean, Dave, Dell, Dell's delivery driver Denise, Denise's dentist Dinesh, and Devon's strongest man, Donathan. Donathan? Donathan, that can't be right. Donathan? Well, whatever your name is, if you're a real person, investing is for you too. AJ Bell, feel good investing. The value of your investments can go up or down.
Lost World Play Barn, Dragon Castle Children's Farm, Jumping Pillows, Wallabies, Froggy Soft Play. Tommy Tractor Play Barn, Quarter Pillar Rowing Boats, Owl Displays, Meerkats, Honey Pot Bears. And four giant slides on the brand new Wave Runner 2. Let's plunge!
What's next, Dad?
Cannon Arena Lemurs, Jungle Kingdom Go-Karts, Trampolines, Magical Wood and Cafes.
Nutcatch Adventure Park. Book now at nutcatch.com.
Ash Cooper.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
7:34 the time, we'll get a view from the city about the impact of the Iran war on food prices, on the actually the direction of travel the government is going in when it comes to trade and cooperation, particularly regards to the EU. We'll hear from Christian May in just a few moments. We'll talk about that Artemis 2 launch in the States. First, Ali's in Slough on what we heard from the president last night. Hi, Ali.
Hi, good morning, Tom. In answer to your question, this war did not need to happen. It's the equivalent of what the Nazis did during the Second World War with Israel and America occupying other states, subjecting them to the blitz that we had in London during the Second World War.
So you've gone straight, sir, just within 10 seconds of the call, you've gone straight to a Nazi comparison, have we?
Well, what? Conceptually, if you're occupying your neighbours and raining missiles down on London during the blitz, what's the difference? What's the difference?
Thankfully, the Nazis never occupied this country. They bombed it, but they never occupied it. In the same way that America is not occupying Iran. It doesn't have boots on the ground at all.
America is defending the occupation of the Golan Heights, of Lebanon, of parts of the West Bank and Palestine. And it is looking to put boots on the ground. It's got bases all around the Middle East.
Yes.
It's quasi-occupation. What else is it?
But it's not quasi-occupation to have bases in countries where those countries have agreed to have those bases, in the same way that America does not occupy England because it has bases here.
You need to look at what happened during the Second World War.
I think you need to find a definition of the word occupy, matey.
No, I will do. if you want to make a point, read what the Americans did to Britain. If you don't sign over the bases, we're not going to give you rusting frigates and corvettes to defend the Channel against the Nazis. You need to acquaint yourself with history, my friend.
So we were wrong to make that choice?
Because you were given no choice. It's rather, I'll make you an offer that you can't refuse, as the Corleone said in The Godfather.
It still doesn't amount to occupation, Ali.
It does amount to occupation. There was no threat to Britain from, Iran. This country's government has not attacked the Iranians, not joining the war. So you're more patriotic to Britain than the average Briton in this country, are you?
In what sense? Sorry, I don't follow.
Why are you cheerleading an unlawful genocide campaign in the Middle East?
I don't think I have been cheerleading it.
You are cheerleading it. Well, then condemn it.
I've just said that the president clearly doesn't have a plan to get out of this, that Keir Starmer was right not to follow him into it on the basis of that there was no plan. But I also really, really don't want the Iranians, certainly the regime as it currently is constituted, to have a nuclear weapon. That would be an absolutely terrible thing. Where's the evidence to suggest that they were imminently going to have one? Donald Trump hasn't provided it yet. Ali, thank you. 7:36. Let's speak to Christian May, Editor-in-Chief at City AM Christian, some of the effects that the war is having, particularly now on food, but also on the ire and fury of the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves.
Yes, good morning, Tom. The Chancellor spoke yesterday out and about talking to the media. She let it be known that she's furious with the war itself and with Donald Trump, and as you've just been discussing, perhaps with the lack of a plan to bring it to any kind of conclusion. Yeah. And I can understand why she would be, because this country's economy was shrinking when we went into the war, and I'm afraid it's going to take a pretty disastrous toll on what possible growth efforts were underway before the war started. Just recall that GDP growth was going from 0.7 to 0.3 to 0.1 all the way throughout the last year, and it wasn't off to a great start. For a government that's made growth its central mission, the Chancellor now faces the prospect of presiding over a recession.
Yeah.
Now, that brings with it all sorts of questions, all sorts of political pressures and economic pressures that a Labour government would respond to in perhaps different ways to a Tory government. And so you can understand why the Chancellor is distressed, to put it mildly.
Not, as you say, not least because the government has rather pinned its hopes electorally on people feeling richer, and this war isn't going to help. Not least because we learned from the Food and Drink Federation that the cost of food could go up by 10%.
Yes, at the moment, food inflation is pretty low single digits. And of course, put that in the context that prior to this war, Tom, everybody was anticipating that inflation was going to come back down to the 2% target this year and that therefore interest rates would start, will continue to slide down. Those things aren't happening anymore. Food and Drink Federation warning of a 9 or 10% spike in food inflation. Now, the supermarkets met Chancellor Rachel Reeves in Downing Street yesterday, the bosses of various supermarkets. And we're told that that was a productive conversation. You would hope so. The conversation had been attempted to take place at the end of last week, but supermarket bosses at the end of last week said they were a little busy.
Yes.
I think they didn't care for the tone. It was suggested that perhaps the Chancellor wanted to wag her finger and lecture them about profiteering.
Yeah, they weren't happy about that.
No, they weren't happy about that, and you can understand why, because their margins are wafer thin. They do an extraordinary job in the most competitive sector. Anyway, it was, we're told, a productive conversation. People we spoke to yesterday who were going to that meeting said, we're going to take the opportunity to point out all the new levies on our energy costs, all the new taxes on our packaging, all the new regulations on what we can and can't promote and sell, all the new costs on our labour force. So I think, I would hope at least, the Chancellor was in listening mode yesterday.
And a word, she was angry yesterday, maybe she was angered by what the supermarket bosses were telling her. A word too on the fate of the property developer Berkeley, because this connects pretty directly to the government's plan to build more homes, or hope to build more homes.
Certainly does. Berkeley Group is London's biggest house builder. Now, I believe it was Mark Twain who once suggested that people buy land because they don't make it anymore. Well, that doesn't hold true for, as I say, London's biggest house builder. They have said they're going to stop buying land for future development because of the unprecedented increases in costs and regulation, which mean it's no longer viable for them to do so. This is a pretty bombshell intervention from this major home building group, coming off the back of all sorts of trouble that we've often discussed about what's facing home builders and the property sector in this country. The shares in the group slumped yesterday down about almost 20%. People trying to digest
20%. Gosh.
But it is a major blow to the government's house building agenda. Berkeley Group said that it doesn't believe it can make the required rate of return on any investment in new land acquisitions. And you've got to put this in perspective. The number of starts slated for home building next year in London is dangerously and painfully low. And off the back of this intervention, clearly Berkeley Group aren't going to contribute to that in any meaningful way anytime soon.
Have yourself a good Easter if I don't see you before, Christian. Thank you very much indeed. Christian May is the editor-in-chief at City AM, 7:41 the time. Next.
RS25 engines. Lift. 4, 3, 2, 1. Booster ignition. And lift off. The crew of Artemis 2 now bound for the moon. Humanity's next great voyage begins.
That's a great gig, isn't it? To commentate on the launch of a rocket. You really can't stuff that one up. If you get your words wrong, or you get them in the wrong order, you've really lost out. Artemis 2 has blasted off for space, or at least to orbit space, a 10-day mission to go and see how easy it might be in the future to land something on the moon and even to create semi-habitable structures by the end of the decade. Greg Smy-Runsby is space expert for Astronomy Now. Thank you very much indeed for coming on the programme, Greg. An extraordinary mission. What's its success? What would a successful mission look like?
Well, simply going to the moon, looping around the back of the moon, and then coming back and splashing down into the ocean off the coast of the United States near San Diego, I think it is. And that will be the mission. That will be it.
Right.
They're literally testing out the spacecraft to see if it is fully capable of taking astronauts to the moon and back.
So this is a kind of a test drive. This is a once-round car park style situation.
Absolutely. Let's see how the learner driver copes. Let's put them in a car park first. It is a little bit like that.
It's a heck of an expensive car park, this. Some 70 billion quid so far spent. And the aim ultimately is to land on the moon and build on the moon.
It is. Just to put things in perspective, a lot of countries and a lot of space agencies and private agencies are building rockets that are reusable. Unfortunately, Artemis is sort of bolted together from old Apollo and Shuttle eras.
Jeez.
And as a result, you're going to throw that rocket away each time. So every time you want to launch the Artemis rocket, the Artemis program, the SLS, you have to rebuild the rocket. And each rocket costs getting close to $3 billion.
Wow.
Now, I know Elon Musk is Marmite man. Some people really hate him. But he does have a fantastic rocket called Starship. And there's a couple of other private adventures around the world where they are building very large reusable rockets. And the Starship, which is Elon Musk's baby, can take astronauts to the moon and bring them safely back. He hasn't done so yet because, like Artemis, he's still testing his rocket. But the big difference is his rocket is fully reusable. No bits get thrown away.
Extraordinary that they have not put a man on the moon or a person on the moon for 50 years. Why is that, Greg? Presumably, well, technologically, we can do this. We've done it before. The technology's improved so massively since.
Okay, I'm going to be in the planetarium at the Royal Observatory today, this morning. Right. I'm going to be talking to kids, and they'll probably ask me questions about this launch, no doubt. The point being is that I remember watching Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin at the age of 16 walking on the lunar surface. But that was taking sandwiches. They just had enough water. They just had enough food. They just had enough toilet paper. They just had the right amount to do that very, very tightly managed enterprise. Today, nobody wants to do that. They want to go to the moon, land on the moon, and stay there. And that's a much, much bigger project than simply hoping upon hope that your very simple sandwich-based mission works.
So we could do it again in the same way that they did for that Apollo mission. We could send people up there. They could knock a golf ball around. We could come home. But we don't want to do that. We want to make it better. We want to build, I don't know, a hotel on a hotel. We want to build stuff on the moon and do experiments there.
Absolutely. And your use of the word hotel is actually much better. Because at the moment, the astronauts are packed into quite a small space. I mean, it's just about okay for 10 days. It's like sitting in the back of a transit van. That's pretty much the amount of space they got. But the great thing is they're not stuck to the floor of the transit van. They can float around inside the transit van. So the space is a little bit more manageable. But when they get onto the moon in the not-too-distant future, they do want a much more comfortable environment. Yeah. So your word hotel actually isn't that bad.
I just think it would be very typical. It would be very 2026 if the thing that happened on the moon first was suddenly there was a Premier Inn sign flashing on the south pole of the moon. Greg, thank you very much indeed. Greg Smy-Runsby is a space expert from Astronomy Now. You're listening to Tom Swarbrick on LBC. Coming up... God, I slightly forgot where I was there. I felt I was going to be at home watching something. The government is setting out a plan to make subscriptions, yes, like Netflix, clearer and easier to cancel. Right, is this one of the things that's going to help us through this cost of living crisis? You'll hear from the minister next. 7:46, headlines, Dominic Ellis.
NASA's first crewed mission to the moon in more than 50 years has blasted off from Cape Canaveral in Florida. President Trump says the United States is getting very close to completing its military objectives in Iran. And the government has withdrawn an offer to create 1,000 extra training places for resident doctors in England. LBC weather, a sunny start for many but gradually clouding over through the day. Heavy rain for Northern Ireland and Western Scotland. Later, a high of 13 degrees.
LBC Travel, I'm Joanne Webb. The M23 is closed northbound between junctions 10 at Crawley and 9 at Gatwick Airport. It's because a car's left the motorway and hit a tree. There are delays all the way back past junction 10A, but if you're heading this way to Gatwick Airport, then obviously do allow yourself extra time. Still quite slow on the M25 clockwise at junction 6 at Godstone after that car broke down earlier, although it has now been recovered. Very busy on the South Circular Road in both directions heading towards Kew. It's because the traffic lights at Kew Bridge aren't working. On the underground, the Piccadilly line is suspended between Acton Town and Rayners Lane. Then there are severe delays on the Circle District and Hammersmith and City lines.
Hear every side of the story. This is LBC.
Here's football legend Jamie Redknapp for new hands-free Skechers Slip-ins footwear.
As a football player, I'm used to not using my hands. So when Skechers came out with hands-free shoes, it was a match made in heaven. Because with new Skechers Slip-ins, I just step in and go, without bending down or touching my shoes.
Find Skechers Slip-ins at a Skechers store or skechers.co.uk.
LBC.
Experience. It's knowing when something is worth waiting for and when it isn't. That's why Saga Health Insurance offers unlimited GP appointments whenever you need them. With a choice of flexible plans, prompt tests and treatment, your health is taken care of. And right now, you'll get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance.
Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
You're driving down the back roads of Tuscany. The sun's setting. The wind's in your hair. You're playing your favourite tunes. No, not that one. Much better. Could life be any sweeter? Of course it can. With the money you've saved by comparing car hire prices through Kayak, you've got more to spend on some fresh, creamy gelato. Mmm, we'll take due scoops, per favore. Search Kayak and go see for yourself.
Big motoring world are big on value. But what does that mean for you? Well, we price check our cars every day, so we can give you the best price. Guaranteed. In fact, 95% of our cars are priced below market value. Big Motoring World, we're big on value. See website for nearest store. Visit bigmotoringworld.co.uk or one of our stores for our price promise and terms and conditions.
Here's a tale of two commuters. Steve was in a rush and needed to park near the station. Jane also needed a space and booked in advance with Your Parking Space. Steve had a meeting at 9 and panic at 8. Nowhere to park. Jane, she's already in the office and enjoying that morning latte. With Your Parking Space, you can browse thousands of spaces across London and reserve the perfect one instantly. Get £10 off your first booking. Download the Your Parking Space app today.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
Time to make the time. Tom Swarbrick here on LBC. After the news at 8 o'clock, we'll look at Keir Starmer's comments about the direction of travel being much, much, much more European after his speech yesterday. But let's take a look at this. New measures set out to make subscriptions clearer and far easier to manage or cancel will, the government say, help save consumers around £400 million a year, with new rules to stop free trials turning into pricey surprises. Kate Dearden is Minister for Employment Rights and Consumer Protection and Labour MP for Halifax. Thank you very much indeed for coming on the programme, Minister. So what happens here? I sign up for Netflix and the government helps me how? Morning.
Morning, Tom. Great to be with you. Thank you for having me on your show. So our announcement today, as you mentioned, will save consumers so much money, £400 million over a year, depending on how many subscriptions they have. Mm-hmm. And what we're doing is making sure that people's hard-earned cash, that they have more control over it and where they spend. So making it really simple and much clearer about signing up for a subscription and making it as easy to leave a subscription as it was to sign up for it. So what we'll have is really clear rules on businesses to make sure that they're providing upfront how when a free trial, for example, is coming to an end, that it's really clear how you can exit a subscription, a much far easier process and less painful, as I've heard lots of stories of people going through trying to exit subscriptions and just making sure that you do have that control as to how you want to exit a subscription. So, every penny counts and things like this.
So I sign up for the thing. It says it's free to sign up for 2 weeks. After that 2 weeks, it's $39.99 a minute. And the government gets involved at what stage?
So what we're saying is the businesses, they really clearly need to give reminders to people that a free trial, for example, might be coming to an end.
Yes.
And so then consumers themselves can understand, you know, what subscriptions they're signed up to.
Yeah.
And if they want to exit a subscription, exactly when they need to do that.
There's lots of consumer protection around that already, isn't there? There's lots of things that consumers can do to guarantee there's all kinds of cooling off periods. What about this is new or different?
So ensuring that businesses can, you know, really, really clearly to consumers include those reminders will be really important going forwards for the subscriptions, but also for renewal. So that's what's new in terms of a cooling off period. That if your subscription as an annual one is coming up for renewal, that you'll have that cooling off period of 14 days as well. So if you decide that you want to cancel that subscription, that you can, and sort of if the rules haven't been put in place by businesses to make sure that you can get a refund. And if businesses actually don't play by the rules and aren't providing those, for example, reminders or making that really clear, easy process to exit, then there will be consequences in terms of enforcement. So, for example, for trading standards to the CMA, they can impose fines of up to 10% of global turnover. So it could be millions for businesses who don't play by the
and
same
as I,
rules.
I, as the consumer who's been ripped off or not been told about this end, I can go to someone to say, help. Who is that person that I can go to?
Yeah, so it would be trading standards, or through citizens' advice to get advice on how you access that, and then obviously directly with the CMA too. So there's clear enforcement here. But also, if you do feel like you've been ripped off and you haven't had that notice, you weren't aware of that subscription renewing, you can also be entitled to a refund, a partial refund or full. So we're really clear about making sure that consumers do have those rights. And have the ownership and control of their hard-earned cash.
It's great to have more control over your cash, as you say, but there are lots of things that consumers, my listeners, need protecting from at the moment, given the price rises. And with the greatest of respect, Minister, this feels a little like deck chairs on the Titanic at this moment, because fuel prices are going up by 10%. There's food inflation coming around the corner about 10%. At the moment, the help that the government is giving amounts to, we'll watch a Netflix subscription for you.
That's not the case, Tom. This policy we're announcing today, been working on since we got into government. We consulted on it last year. So it's something that we've been working on for a long period of time and isn't in response to this crisis. It is, of course, helpful for the cost of living, but isn't the only thing that we're doing. So we are really ensuring, with a crisis, completely understand people's concerns.
Well, what else is happening?
Because
I heard a lot from the Prime Minister in the last week.
Finances here at home with the cost of living. So you've seen in recent weeks, in terms of heating oil, the intervention we have made there to support people, but also announcing our crisis and resilience fund, which is $1 billion for councils across the country, so they can decide exactly how they can support people locally, and it's up for them to do that. And we'll continue to assess the situation every single day as it becomes more uncertain. Yeah. We know it's going to be difficult. We're not sure how long it's going to go on for, and I know that's hard for people. So in terms of the immediate reactions, we will assess this every single day in the crisis to make sure that we can support people's cost of living.
Well, the Prime Minister said we've got your back.
We're ensuring...
Sorry, Minister. The Prime Minister said we've got your back, but a lot of people would see what's happened over the last 2 years as their taxes have gone up, prices have increased. That's not always the government's fault, but their taxes have gone up to the point where 2/3 of the hospitality sector are going to say that they're laying off jobs. That doesn't really feel like a government that's got the backs of the working people that Keir Starmer said he was going to look after when he first came in.
And our job, of course, and what we're committed to is supporting those brilliant businesses, particularly the hospitality sector, and building that stronger, more resilient economy.
You're smashing them. These business rate hikes in hospitalities for cafes and hotels and restaurants are an absolute shambles.
I, of course, recognise the pressures that businesses are under. When we've got a crisis like we have, it doesn't just affect consumers and people across the country. It affects businesses too. That's why we want to make sure that, our economy going forward is absolutely stronger, more stable, more secure. That helps businesses, it helps people. Mm-hmm. And in terms of that longer term cost of living, with the announcements yesterday in terms of the increases to national minimum and living wage, our announcements on fuel duty, on prescription charges. We're doing so much to make sure that the day-to-day spending for people, that we can put more money back in their pockets, really recognise those pressures. But of course, for businesses, making sure that work pays. We are a party of work. We want to make sure that good work is something that's secure for people across the country and for workers too,
first.
And supporting that demand. And of course, jobs are absolutely vital, and that's why businesses are too. I meet with businesses regularly in my job, my constituency, and in the department, listening to their pressures, concerns, where the opportunities are for them. And we know absolutely that businesses benefit from a stable, strong economy, and that's what we're committed to working towards over the months and years ahead.
What is the government policy when it comes to drilling in the North Sea?
So our manifesto was really clear, that oil and gas will be part of our energy mix for years to come. And the licences that were granted before the election were challenged in the courts. And we've said that we would honour those existing licences, but we are waiting for that process to complete. And more widely, we are absolutely committed to investing in renewables. Crises like we've seen in the Middle East have exposed the volatility of international markets. So we want to make sure that we can have more homegrown
so we do
clean
like
energy
drilling
here
in the
UK.
North Sea. That when the Chancellor said yesterday that she backs drilling in the North Sea, that is a move supported by the whole of government.
So, yeah, our manifesto was clear about oil and gas being a key part of our energy mix for years to come.
Well, hang on, because I thought Mr. Miliband was saying Treasury, this isn't going to happen again. We can't keep drilling in the North Sea, Mr. Miliband has been suggesting.
So in terms of the licences that I mentioned, that we would honour those existing licences, but we're waiting for that process to complete that are currently being challenged in the courts. But we have said in terms of existing licences, with the tiebacks in particular, for the fields that the current licences can drill in and where they can expand to, in terms of the sort of neighbouring
fields. So we are going to drill in the North
fields.
Sea?
In terms of the existing licences, we've been really clear about that. But Rachel, with Ed Miliband and colleagues in Desmes, are really clear about our investment in renewables and are working on that too.
I'm sure they're really clear.
But that's our commitment in the future for homegrown energy.
We've
been clear about the mix for years to come.
Just to be really, really, really clear. The government is happy to continue to drill for oil and gas in the North Sea under those existing licences, as the Chancellor seems to be supporting in the papers today.
So, yeah, on the existing licences, you know, we were clear in our manifesto about oil and gas being part of that mix for years to come. I've mentioned what's been challenged in the courts. We have to wait for that process to complete before, where, as we said, we'd honour those existing licences, but really recognise what's happening in the courts. More broadly, we're absolutely committed to renewables and that homegrown energy. You've seen the investments that we have done in terms of renewables, more solar in the first 14 months. This government, 14 years, the previous one, £90 billion of private investment, and lots of jobs, of course, supported by green energy, green jobs too. And that mix is really important, especially when we look to crises like we're seeing in the Middle East.
Appreciate your time.
We want to make sure we're more resilient and not relying on that.
Appreciate your time. Thank you very much indeed for coming on. Kate Dearden is the Minister for Employment Rights and Consumer Protection, Labour MP for Halifax. You're listening to Tom Swarbrick on LBC. After the news at 8...
I have some sympathy with the BBC. I mean, they were kind of damned if they did, and they damned if they didn't.
It turns out the BBC did know of the police investigation into sacked DJ Scott Mills back in 2017. We'll get the latest.
I don't think that this dispute is resolved by headline generation, and I don't think that it's resolved by making threats.
The resident doctors choose to go on strike again. The government is livid. Your chance to question the head of the BMA union later in the programme. Plus...
It is increasingly clear that as the world continues down this volatile path, our long-term national interest requires closer partnership with our allies in Europe.
Keir Starmer wants a much closer relationship with Europe, saying Brexit did huge damage to the economy. After the news, as European countries meet to discuss the Hormuz, should we get back to the EU?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, NASA's first crewed mission to the moon in more than 50 years has blasted off from Florida.
Booster ignition and liftoff. The crew of Artemis 2 now bound for the moon. Humanity's next great voyage begins.
Artemis 2 is due to take the crew further into space than anyone has gone before. The mission won't land on the moon, but will pass its far side, hopefully paving the way for a lunar mission in 2 years' time. These people were in Cape Canaveral for blastoff.
That is the best thing humanity can do. That is the absolute extent of the science that we have, and we just did it, and we got to watch it.
Absolutely awesome. Unbelievable. And great to be here to experience it.
It was very good. Very fascinating.
President Trump says the United States is on track to complete all of its objectives in the war in Iran very shortly. In a televised address overnight, he said America will hit the country extremely hard over the next 2 to 3 weeks. Mr. Trump also had this message for other countries hoping to see the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz.
Build up some delayed courage. Should have done it before. Should have done it with us, as we asked. Go to the Strait and just take it. Protect it.
The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, will host a virtual meeting of international leaders later to assess diplomatic options on how to reopen the strait. Since Mr. Trump's speech, oil prices have risen by around 7% to $107 a barrel. The motoring group, the RAC, has reported record monthly increases in fuel prices in March because of the conflict. Average petrol prices surged by 20p a litre, while diesel was 40 pence higher. The government has withdrawn an offer to create 1,000 extra training places for resident doctors in England. Sir Keir Starmer had given the doctors' union, the BMA, a deadline of 48 hours to call off next week's strike or face losing the posts. And new rules to protect people from so-called subscription traps have been announced by the government. Companies will now have to give customers a cooling-off period and make it straightforward to cancel. Speaking to Tom in the last few minutes, the Minister for Consumer Protection, Kate Dearden, said the change will save people an average of around £170 a year.
Businesses actually don't play by the rules and aren't providing those, for example, reminders or making that really clear, easy process to exit, then there will be consequences in
what
terms of enforcement. So, for example, for trading standards to the CMA, they can impose fines of up to 10% of global turnover. So it could be millions for businesses.
In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 reopened at 10,364. It closed up 188. Yesterday, the pound buys $1.33 and €1.14. LBC weather, a sunny start for many, but turning cloudy later. Some heavy rain for Northern Ireland and the west of Scotland by the afternoon. A high of 13 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
At Lidl, get everyone around the table this Easter with fresh veg from only 4p each. With cracking prices on British Swedes, parsnips, 1 kilogram of carrots and 2 kilograms of potatoes for 8p. And more. That's sure to put a spring in your step. Lidl. More to value. Subject to availability. Selected stores. GB only.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation. Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick.
Morning to you, 4 minutes past eight the time. Tom Swarbrick in for Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC. Hope we find you very well this Thursday morning. Coming up.
Hold on. Is this what? Look at
It's called a link-up, but the events turned a little violent in Clapham when this has happened over the last few days, and now we have parenting lessons from the police, the Met telling parents of those teenagers to turn up at these things to get a grip. Is this down to a lack of parenting? And
we should be cutting costs of people's bills. We know people are struggling with energy bills. We know the war in Iran is going to make that worse.
As Rachel Reeves indicates, the government might be looking at drilling in the North Sea. The Conservative Party will axe the carbon tax, they say, to stop the deindustrialisation of Britain and cut bills. We'll speak to their energy spokesperson.
Call 0345 6060 973. Tweet at LBC. Text 84850. Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
Very good morning to you. First this hour.
Our long-term national interest requires closer partnership with our allies in Europe.
As the government convenes 35 countries, not the US, to explore ways to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, including French and German and Italian foreign ministers, Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, says that we need to make a pivot towards the EU. So Keir Starmer saying yesterday that Britain would pivot more closely towards the EU, securing a partnership for this dangerous world, he says, that we must navigate together. The Prime Minister said building stronger defence and economic ties with Europe would be at the centre of an EU-UK summit this summer, adding that he would not bow to pressure from the US President and be dragged into a wider war in the Middle East. Here's a little of what he said.
We have made progress on this front, on agriculture, electricity, emissions trading and more. But as the Chancellor has rightly pointed out, Brexit did deep damage to our economy and the opportunities to strengthen our security and cut the cost of living are simply too big to ignore.
Keir Starmer making that pivot towards the European Union, as he said that Brexit caused deep damage to the economy, signalling he wants a new level of ambition for that summit planned in the summer that would not just ratify the existing commitments made at last year's summit, but going further, being more ambitious, building closer economic cooperation and closer security cooperation. Now, last time we tried to get closer security cooperation, we hit a buffer because the new EU defence initiative got stuck because they demanded a pretty high entry fee for the UK to join. And they don't particularly like attempts to join parts of the single market that are often viewed as cherry picking. So if we're going to have a closer relationship, we need to do something quite big. And I wonder what you think that might be, whether you think that would be unreasonable to say, I don't know,
whether it's go back to the customs union or join a different kind of customs union or bring in some forms of whatever the single market elements that we like without freedom of movement perhaps could be squared away by the EU. Do you see this country's future as being further, closer, more integrated with the EU, particularly given what is happening in the United States? That Keir Starmer is right to say that Brexit did severe damage to the UK economy. We'll speak to Lord Jim O'Neill in just a moment. Simon Marks joins me. You are LBC's Washington correspondent here this afternoon on LBC from 4. Very good time for a radio programme, that. Simon, thank you very much indeed for coming on. This is probably a natural move, isn't it, given what's coming our way over the Atlantic?
Oh, I think there's no doubt about that, Tom. And everything that we heard from President Trump in his primetime address last night really boosts the notion that the United Kingdom is not going to be able to rely on the United States for security protection in the event of any kind of Russian aggression. He didn't launch last night a direct attack on NATO, even though the president had told the Reuters news agency earlier in the day that that was going to be included in his speech. But with regard to the future of the Strait of Hormuz, listen to the language that he used as he promised the nation and the world that once the conflict is over, as he put it, the Strait of Hormuz is naturally going to reopen. But in the meantime, this is what he's suggested nations that haven't been there fighting alongside him in an effort, as he puts it, to try and prevent Iran from ever accessing a nuclear weapon. This is what they ought to do about their energy supplies.
To those countries that can't get fuel, many of which refuse to get involved in the decapitation of Iran, we had to do it ourselves. I have a suggestion. Number one, buy oil from the United States of America. We have plenty. We have so much. And number two, build up some delayed courage. Should have done it before. Should have done it with us, as we asked. Go to the Strait and just take it. Protect it. Use it for yourselves.
A clarion definition of economic imperialism there from a president of the United States who never answered the central question last night that must be in the minds of millions of Americans as they fill their cars up with petrol that is now on average costing $4 a gallon and is going to probably head further north. Why is it that a country he portrayed last night as being swimming in oil, the United States, entirely self-sufficient, we don't need Iranian oil, in fact the rest of the world should come and buy ours. Why is it that the petrol price in the United States continues to tick upwards the longer this conflict continues? The president very much, I think, in that speech last night, indicating that he intends to keep going for many weeks to come, potentially, which is why the prime minister yesterday and other international leaders were warning their domestic populations to brace for enormous turbulence ahead.
Simon, appreciate it as always. Thank you so much. Simon Marks, LBC's Washington correspondent here on LBC this afternoon at 4 o'clock. 8:10, Lord Jim O'Neill joins us, former chief economist at Goldman Sachs, commercial secretary to the Treasury some time ago, and advisor to Rachel Reeves when the Labour Party were in opposition. Thank you very much indeed for coming on the programme, Jim. There is a report in one of the papers today from the Bank of England saying that Britain risks a financial crisis that leaves households battling higher borrowing costs and huge prices. How bad is this going to get for us, do you think? Morning.
That sounds like a lovely headline. you know, what is it about us that anything that goes on in the world, we all manage to see the absolute worst always affecting us? I think there's... I don't know what it is. It's sort of... I was listening to your intro about Brexit 10 years on and all the rest of it. We seem to find a way of, partly because of we've had a bad time, thinking that whatever's going on, the worst outcomes are going to affect us. You know, this shock, if you could call it that, driven by the US president, is pretty bad for a very large number of countries.
Yes.
And we can't in ourselves control it. In fact, it doesn't look like President Trump can. But so I think the real approach to deal with these things is to, through time, build our own stronger economic resilience and, most importantly, productivity, so that when these things happen, and they will happen again in the future, we can bounce back much stronger than we otherwise could. And listening, I think I can only really think about it in the context of the broader thing of the EU and what's happened since then, because one of the reasons why we're having so many problems over the past decade is because we're still living from that pretty colossal economic shock, which is causing more permanent damage, in my opinion, than this oil shock, oil price shock, or energy price shock is likely to do.
When the Prime Minister said yesterday about reimagining a, well, having a stronger, safer country after this, this is a challenge for the generation that we can't go back to the status quo. What are the things, give me one thing that you think must change as a result of all of this, Jim?
So I think the absolute most important thing, which is hard, but ironically, until 5 weeks ago, there were the beginnings of some signs of it changing, is we need to have stronger productivity where we are producing more with the same number of people than we had been, because that's the route to having higher living standards and greater real wage increases for more people. And since the financial crisis in 2008, exaggerated by our rather odd decision to leave the EU, it's made it worse. And that's why a lot of people around the country, particularly those less well off, always feel so bad every time there's a shock. And that is at the core of it. So boosting, and there's parts of, doesn't often feel it most days or weeks, but there's parts of what this government has tried to put in place that, in my opinion, are the right thing. So we need to boost investments, both the government itself and to encourage our own private companies to invest more.
Would that investment be more likely if we had a closer relationship with the European Union, as the PM suggests? And what does that close relationship actually mean? What does it look like?
I mean, I hear that this doesn't cause too many trouble for some. I hear effectively the leadership of this government saying they wish we were still in the single market, but they can't say that because of the politics of immigration. But I wouldn't mind, I'm no political scientist, but I wouldn't mind guessing that for the next election in another 3 years' time, or whatever it is, the Labour government will actually stand on a mission of rejoining the single market. And it certainly seems to me, if you look at the complexity of the political dynamic they face, yes, a lot of it's been driven by the fear of reform and the Tories took us out, but to the left of this government, you've now got the Greens on the scene, and it's pretty clear with younger people, they don't really understand why we ever left in the first place.
And to be clear, rejoining the single market would mean payments to the European Union. It would mean presumably accepting, again, freedom of movement. But that works two ways.
Well, it does work two ways. But I also think, given the issues that have gone on with immigration for a lot of EU countries as well, we are probably heading to a future, which, again, is yet another tricky thing for countries, where there will be a different way of thinking about aspects of migration that has sort of been the background to the human rights aspects of this, probably going all the way back to World War II. And so there's a lot of changing things that are going on at the same time. But yes, it would mean all of those things, because at the end of the day, as evidenced by the economic data, being in the single market gave us, from a labour flexibility and from an investment and trade perspective, significant benefits which we have lost and are still showing ongoing signs of losing.
The trade comes in part from the customs union, though, which you don't think we should be back in?
I don't think that gives, I mean, that would be a second best. I think the single market gives you a lot more. Think of our universities and how our leaders of our universities often complain about the greater difficulty that they now have having access to all the best, genuine intellectual talent that existed so naturally before. And our universities are arguably the single strongest thing the UK faces in this modern complex world. So I think it's more than just the pure, simple trade benefits. But of course, they're a huge part of it.
Really appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on again. Jim O'Neill, Lord Jim O'Neill, former chief economist at Goldman Sachs, commercial secretary to the Treasury advisor to Rachel Reeves when the Labour Party were in opposition. So that's the case. As you heard Jim O'Neill say there, Labour should campaign to rejoin the single market at the next election. That the politics of that might be ugly. Yes, it's 10 years since we left. Oh, my God, let's not rehash it all now.
But look at what's happening over the other side of the pond. Look at the friendly welcome we're getting from the United States. We went alone for 6 years, really, so far. 10 years by 2030. Has it gone brilliantly? If Labour said at the next election, we are going to rejoin the single market in some form, would you be more likely to vote for them? Would it be the best thing to do for the British economy? 03456060973. Come to your calls in just a moment. Tom Swarbrick here. Coming up...
What they have said very recently is that the new information has come to light. And on the basis of that new information, they've decided to get rid of him.
It turns out the BBC did know of the police investigation into sacked DJ Scott Mills back in 2017. Bringing you the latest on that development in a few moments. 8:18, God, late for the news headlines. Dominic Ellis.
NASA's first crewed mission to the moon in more than 50 years has blasted off from Cape Canaveral in Florida. President Trump says the United States is getting very close to completing its military objectives in Iran. And the government has withdrawn an offer to create 1,000 extra training places for resident doctors in England. LBC weather, a sunny start for many, but gradually clouding over through the day. Heavy rain for Northern Ireland and Western Scotland. Later, a high of 13 degrees.
LBC Travel, I'm Joanne Webb. The M23 is closed northbound between junctions 10 at Crawley and 9 at Gatwick Airport. It's because of an ongoing investigation. Those delays now go all the way back to junction 11 at Pease Pottage. Southbound is open but slow because of onlookers, and the A23 is also extremely congested. Now, elsewhere on the motorways, one lane's closed on the M1 southbound just before junction 9 at Redbourne after an accident, and that's causing queues. Very busy in Esher on the High Street going southbound. There's been an accident at Esher Green. And on the underground, the Piccadilly line can't run between Acton Town and Rayners Lane, also between the Heathrow terminals, and there are severe delays on the Victoria, Hammersmith and City District and Circle lines.
LBC.
For those precious, messy mornings that matter, start with heart. A bowl of Yo Valley Organic Greek-style yoghurt, topped with Yo Valley Organic tray-baked granola. Proper yoghurt, proper crunch. It's a wholesome, creamy and deliciously nutty breakfast that will keep you going all morning. Yo Valley Organic. Breakfast made with real heart. Find it now in a store close to you.
This is LBC.
You know what you're getting with a wedding? Wedding hats. A baby in a waistcoat crying throughout the vows. Themed tables. Awkward best man speech. The plus one?
Hello.
People dancing in a circle. Ruined rental suit. Sometimes in life you just know what you're getting, like a luxury bed and a great night's sleep. You know what you're getting with Premier Inn.
At Amazon, over 50% of deliveries now come with less packaging or with no added packaging at all. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep. Where you chat with friends, where your neighbour's daughter practices guitar, and where we deliver your new noise-cancelling headphones in the manufacturer's packaging. Ah, much better. Reduced packaging from Amazon. We're delivering change where it matters. On your doorstep. Based on 2025 Amazon packaging data across the UK and EU.
Interactive Investor would like to say welcome and thank you. Welcome to all our new investors who joined us over the past few months. And thank you to a certain competitor that decided to change their fee structure and sent them all our way. Visit Interactive Investor to see what you could save with our low flat fee. Interactive Investor. I think, therefore I. Remember, when investing, your capital is at risk.
Nick Ferrari at Breakfast with Tom Swarbrick on LBC. Call 0345 6060973. This is LBC.
8:21, the time. Tom Swarbrick here on LBC, picking up on the comments of the Prime Minister yesterday that he wants to lean very heavily towards Brussels, described Brexit as doing deep damage to the UK economy, particularly as the US president taunts him, acts belligerently, throws allies under the bus as he flips around about the war in Iran. And there's Keir Starmer saying, right, well, we need to get closer to our European partners. We want to do more on defence, obviously. We want to do more on the economy. With Britain at risk of a financial crisis, the Bank of England is warning, I wonder whether you think there's a world in which a Labour leader, whether it's Keir Starmer or someone else by the time of the next election, says, yeah, we want to get back into the single market. Brilliant, as Jim O'Neill was suggesting. Would that be the right thing to do? Sebastian's in Harrow. Sebastian.
Yes, hi, Tom. My point of view here is that whenever we're talking about Europe and possibly joining, we must bring into the equation that it is highly likely that Europe will, if we want to join, they will immediately say, well, okay, you're going to lose the pound and you're going to take the euros now.
Yep.
So are we prepared to put that into the mix as well? And I think possibly that's a big deal for a lot of people, where the sterling and the pound is such a strong currency on its own right that people will want to take on the euro, and there'll be a stumbling block.
That may well be the case. Although, having been in government when the negotiations were started about leaving the European Union, we were not in a position of strength. The UK was not in a position of strength during those negotiations. I think the UK is actually arguably in a much stronger position now if we were to negotiate some form of agreement on a single market terms, because it's not as if European economies are absolutely going gangbusters and we're struggling.
My point here is that it's not just Europe as a collective, but individual countries will say, well, we had to take on the euro. We had to give our own currencies up. So if these other, a new country needs to join, then they need to give up their currency also. And that's going not just for Britain, but any other country wanting to join. It may be in other countries' interest to lose their own currency, but I feel there's a strong opinion about the public here that they'd like to keep the pound. I might be wrong, but
I think you're absolutely right. I don't know how bad the situation would have to be for people to go, yeah, we're willing to lose the pound in order to take the euro I get the sense that people wouldn't want that at all. Appreciate the call. Thank you very much indeed. Here's Michael on WhatsApp. Would I vote for Labour promising to get back into the single market? Yes, 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 and at any cost. And I am not historically a Labour voter, says Michael. Here's Joe. Do you remember all the Brexit arguments about the EU army? Yes, of course. Seems in hindsight that would have been a great idea. What, weren't there allegations that Russia were promoting Brexit? Isn't it in their interests to void an EU army? I feel like we've been played. Well, with all this talk about Trump apparently coming out of NATO or willing to scrap NATO, then that certainly would look likelier. Here's George in Leicester. Tom, morning. Without a referendum, joining would be a disgusting move. And to be clear, while I voted to leave, I would consider rejoining, but only via a referendum. Interesting. So you wouldn't mind of the outcome of it particularly. You just want the method to be the same. I don't think we need another referendum on it? Do you back Keir Starmer's pivot towards Brussels, his insistence that we need much closer relations with the European Union? Do you agree? Get to more of your calls in just a few moments. 8:25 the time. Next.
I don't see how they could have known. I don't think it would be fair to criticise the BBC for not knowing.
Really? The BBC was aware of a police probe into Scott Mills 9 years ago, but only fired him after new information came to light last week, the broadcaster has now admitted. The Met Police yesterday confirmed it had been in contact with the corporation on several occasions over the allegations since 2017, after it was handed the case the previous year. Last night, in an extraordinary statement issued via his lawyers, the 53-year-old former DJ broke his silence to admit he was the subject of the investigation and did not deny the allegations. Adam Sherwin is arts and media correspondent at the I newspaper. Thanks for coming on, Adam. More and more information is sort of dripping out now about what the BBC knew and when. To what extent does it explain their decision to sack Scott Mills?
Yeah, well, it seems that they acted with unusual decisiveness. Some people might even say ruthlessness last week when they received what they call new information. But if they thought that was going to be the end of the matter, that's clearly not the case, because we do now know that people within the BBC knew that there had been a previous complaint that Scott Mills had spoken to BBC figures about that. He'd been kept on air. And of course, that complaint never reached the evidentiary level. So he was never charged. He was never arrested. But clearly somebody in the BBC knew that there had been an issue in the past. Mm-hmm. And people will be asking, was that serious enough for him to carry on air when he was still under investigation at that time?
He was kept on air despite it being known, the Mail reports, that he was interviewed under caution between 2018 and 2019, although, as we know, the CPS said that there was the evidential threshold was not passed to bring any charges.
That's right. And what the BBC is now saying is that we're operating under a kind of a different regime now since the Hugh Edwards affair, that standards have to be met. And it's almost as if any infraction perhaps that comes forward now, the thing to do is to act really ruthlessly, decisively. There's been too many embarrassments, Greg Wallace, those kind of issues. So perhaps what might have led to him being allowed to carry on 10 years ago, now he was presented with new evidence last Monday, it seems, and within 4 days he was out of the door.
And the new evidence last Monday was what?
This is what we don't know, and this is what people have said is leading to this kind of void of rumour and speculation, as Scott Mills said in his statement. I thought it was noticeable that he didn't contest the decision in that particular legal statement to fire him, effectively. Perhaps he accepted that what was presented, particularly at Radio 2, it's a family-friendly station, someone of his calibre, he's across all the BBC's entertainment programme, was a very popular figure within the BBC, he couldn't carry on. So perhaps that new evidence did emerge, perhaps from the original complainant, that was incontrovertible and both parties said he had to go.
Because it seems as if the BBC had already made its decision about Scott Mills' future when they allowed him both to carry on air whilst being questioned by police and under investigation, or at least under caution, and then subsequently. Because no charges were brought, so carry on.
And that was a decision made at the time. There's now going to be, the BBC says it's looking to find out what happened, who made those decisions then, what did they know, what were they told at the time by the police. The police presumably did inform the BBC of all the evidence that they had. And so that decision was made then. It has to have been something significant since then for this whole thing to come up, and perhaps not unconnected to a new director general coming into the BBC in a couple of weeks. And he perhaps wants a fresh start and clear out the stables of any problems that might still exist.
Adam, appreciate it. Thanks for coming on. Adam Sherwin is arts and media correspondent at the I newspaper. It's very messy, this, isn't it? It's all over the place. The bits of information that are just starting to dribble out here and there. Something changed between the BBC knowing that Scott Mills had been interviewed in this fashion some years ago, that an allegation had been made a long time ago, that the CPS were not going to bring any charges. Something must have changed between then and now. Otherwise, in theory, it would seem that Scott Mills was sacked because the BBC became aware that actually it did know about the fact that he was interviewed under caution many, many years ago. Which is an odd form of sacking, isn't it? We've subsequently realised that we did know about your interview under caution by police, even though no charges were brought, so we're getting rid of you. That cannot be the whole story. It doesn't seem to be the whole story. And yet we don't know the whole story, and it's been days and days and days. So what's going on? Robert, I'll come to your call in just a few moments. After the news.
I had just gotten off the tube, coming home from work. I had kind of seen a bit about it online earlier in the day on the Clapham Instagram. Thought it might have settled down, and then it was just sort of chaos up here.
Parenting lessons coming now from the police after viral link-ups turned violent in Clapham. Hundreds of teenagers involved in it. The Met are telling parents to get a grip. To what extent is this behaviour down to, in your view, a lack of, quote, strong parenting? 8:30, news headlines on LBC. Dominic Ellis.
President Trump says the US is getting very close to completing its military objectives in Iran. In a televised address, he said America would subject the country to another 2 to 3 weeks of extremely hard strikes. The government has withdrawn an offer to create 1,000 extra training places for resident doctors in England. Keir Starmer had given the doctors' union a deadline of 48 hours to call off strike action next week or face losing the posts. And NASA's first crewed mission to the moon in more than 50 years has blasted off from Cape Canaveral in Florida. Artemis 2 is due to take the crew further into space than anyone has gone before. LBC weather, a sunny morning for many but turning cloudy later. Heavy rain for Northern Ireland and the west of Scotland by the afternoon. A high of 13 degrees.
This is LBC.
Tony, what do you want to tell me? Good morning.
Scott has called from Glasgow. Hi, Scott.
Jane's in Camden first. Hi, Jane.
Households will benefit from £150 off of their energy bills with a price cap, giving households certainty on their bills until July.
Hear every side of the story.
You feel like asking much of a luxury now to heat your house. Farmer is going to have to get involved.
I'm at the petrol station and it's just cost me nearly £100 to fill up half.
I'm almost in my 40s and I haven't ever had a break in war. In any of these living costs.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app. LBC, leading Britain's conversation.
This year at Amazon, we're increasing the electric vehicles used for deliveries across Europe to over 10,000. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where babies are made a fuss of, where we deliver footballs for kids' kickabouts, and where they deliver the football straight into next door's garden.
Can they have their ball back, please?
We're delivering change where it matters, on your doorstep. Based on projected delivery service partner vehicles across the UK and EU by end of 2026.
You know, Kayak isn't just another flight comparison app. When you download the Kayak app, you download flight enlightenment. With Kayak, you see things others can't, like the latest great deals from both airlines and booking sites. You can filter your searches and set up price alerts so you... Not now.
Oh, sorry.
So you're notified when there's a price drop on the flights you want. See more, do more, save more with Kayak. You can do the gong now. Download the Kayak app today and go see for yourself.
Frustrating is printing a recipe where the quality fades with every ingredient. Smart is a printer that delivers high-quality ink over time. Stressful is your printer choosing check-in day to check out of ink. Smart is an HP Smart Tank with 3 years of cartridge-free ink. Oh, that's smart. So go on, search HP Smart Tank. Find the last printer you'll ever need.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick on LBC. Text 84850.
8:33 the time. Tom Swarbrick here on LBC. We're talking a few moments about the parenting lessons coming from the Met Police after what we've seen in Clapham over the course of the last few nights. A reminder too, after the news at 9 o'clock, we're going to be joined by the head of the BMA union. The resident doctors are out on strike again next week for 6-7 days. We'll be joined by the chair of the BMA Resident Doctors Committee about the talks that they have been having with the government about the pay offer that they were given by the government about the new 1,000 training places that the government have now withdrawn. Love to take your thoughts, your questions for Dr. Jack Fletcher when he joins us after nine about the rights and wrongs, as you see it, of, again, this strike action by those resident doctors. Are they, not that I think that they mind particularly, but are they running out of public sympathy on this one? They've had enormous pay increases. They've had, since 2020, the average cash pay has increased by, wait for it, 33%. That's not a bad deal. It's not where they want to be, but that is not a bad start to getting to where you want to be, isn't it? And here they are rejecting another deal without even putting it to their members. We'll talk to Dr. Jack Fletcher, put your calls and questions to him after the news at 9 o'clock. Robert's in East Grinstead first. Hi, Robert.
Hi. Hi, Tom. Morning. Hi.
Oh, my God, he's speaking from inside the bath.
Let me move. Hold on one second.
No, well, don't get out the bath.
To Barrow, echoey. No, I'm not. I haven't gone that far, Tom. Okay. Is that a bit better?
It's not ideal, but, okay, carry on, Robert. You want to talk about Starmer and the EU?
Yeah, I mean, is that a bit better?
Yeah,
Let me just try and lean out the window. Hold on.
Don't, God's sake, better? Don't get out the bath to lean out the window, man. There'll be complaints.
All right, okay. All right, I'm out the bath. I've done the best, anyway.
Right.
I'm not sitting in the bath, but I'm close to it.
Fine.
With the EU, I mean, if I was a time traveller from coming back to this country from, say, 20 years ago, I would sum up the culture of the UK at the moment is basically, if it sits, it's taxed. If it moves, it's fined. Or it's given some complicated app that makes it difficult to move. That doesn't work. That is the culture. If I was possibly looking abroad, I'd be going, why would I want to get involved with that?
Yeah.
And also, I'd be looking at a prime minister quite seriously when we voted to leave the EU in 2016. Theresa May got a deal off that. She was then voted in with a zero tariff deal. Sir Keir Starmer voted against every deal. I would not have that man in charge of our future with Europe. He's a mess.
Who would do a better job, in your opinion?
I think, I don't know. Personally, my feeling is that ties with Europe, increased economic ties, trading ties will just evolve. You know, naturally, I think that will get more and more seamless and more bureaucrats will get shoved out of the way. I think, and if I was to look towards model countries to work with immediately, our nearest neighbours and possibly Denmark and Sweden just seems to make sense. France seems politically chaotic at the moment. I used to spend a lot of time in Germany and sort of had a real feel for the place there. I haven't been there for a long time. Mm.
All right, Robert, I appreciate the call. Thank you very much indeed. Robert, they're shouting out the window and onto the radio. In East Grinstead. Richard, I'll come to your call in just a sec. 8:37. Next.
Oh, no. Is this real? Look at this. Oh, look at this.
After the so-called link-up events in Clapham, police are now urging parents to, quote, take responsibility after scenes of widespread disorder in southwest London on Saturday and again on Tuesday. Officers saying the incidents were caused by a TikTok trend for swarming the streets. Six teenage girls have been arrested so far. The Met Police said there would be more arrests in the coming days as officers reviewed CCTV and body-worn camera footage of the disorder. You might have seen the footage of it. People have basically barricading themselves in shops. The police going around telling shops to pull their shutters down because there were so many people that descended upon this area. To what extent is this a parental issue or the fault of the parents? Dr. Amanda Gummer is a child psychologist, mum of two, and founder of goodplayguide.com. Thank you for coming on the programme, Dr. Gummer. Is this kids being kids?
I think it goes a bit more than that, doesn't it? I think we want to be able to let our kids go and play outside. That's something that's been missing from childhood for sort of 10, 20 years now. And I think it's the fact that kids don't have that ability when they're younger to go and play with their mates in the local communities, at the local playgrounds, that means that they don't necessarily know how to behave when they are out on their own. And the you know, with social media now, and you can rally up a gang of 100 in one go, that's causing all sorts of problems. But I think it's too complex an issue to just blame parents. I think that's an easy
15, 16, 17 kids these days don't know how to behave in a group. Is that what we're saying?
We're saying that they haven't had that experience of going to the park with their mates and maybe getting into a little bit of trouble, maybe causing a little bit of
well, this
noise
might be
and
it.
Disturbance.
I mean, there were some at the outer edge of that, but for a lot of them, this might be the little bit of trouble they were getting into.
Well, and then hopefully it's a learning opportunity for them. But I think I'd like that to see that learning opportunity happen when they're 7, 8, 9, not when they're 16, 17, 18.
Out on the streets of Clapham. I know, I'm joking with you a minute.
In safe spaces, playgrounds, you know, community spaces, skate parks, basketball courts, you know, just places where kids can go and hang out. There was a really important report by Make Space for Girls a year or two ago that showed that girls particularly don't have anywhere that is designed for them to meet their friends and develop those really important social skills. We want the kids off the screens, but we're not giving them anything else to do.
What would that look like? As the father of a daughter, what would that look like for her?
So it's sensitively designed playgrounds with, you know, places for girls to hang out. Girls tend to, the research shows that they like being up, spinning and you know, swinging upside down. Those kind of activities.
So some swings in the playground.
Swings, places for them to hang out, you know, covered seating areas, monkey bars, just things that they can. But we don't, we haven't. No, they've been going into disrepair over the last 20 years. And there are a lot of
endlessly to playgrounds around us with monkey bars and swings and all that kind of thing. There's a
maybe
basketball.
When they're little.
Yeah.
But generally, there is a decline in children playing outside. And that is what's causing, that's contributing to this factor. Mm. Absolutely, parents need to know where their kids are at and teach them right from wrong and all of that kind of stuff. But as a society, we are letting our kids down.
To what extent do you think this is down to esteem, social collateral drawn out from being on social media and being seen to be at these events where you can film it and stick it on your Instagram profile or your TikTok profile, that there's some kudos attached to that?
Yeah, absolutely. And these kids doing this are fueling all the people who say that kids shouldn't have access to social media until they're 16. And I have to say that on the current evidence, that's my position too. But I'd like to see a much more graduated process so that children are able to learn the skills they need to behave responsibly. And kids are going to make mistakes, and that's part of childhood. And we need to give them the space to do that safely. But we need to make sure that children aren't being given free access to digital tools and social media that aren't designed for them.
Really appreciate your time. Thank you for coming on. Dr. Amanda Gummer is a child psychologist, mum of two, founder of goodplayguide.com. We roll out a national campaign, a national tournament of Kirby. That's what we need. Everyone, young people now, need to learn how to play Kirby And we engage in a national competition to find Britain's best Kirby player. And that will get kids outside and playing and doing all, you know, burning off some energy without getting themselves in trouble. I don't. The social media revolution has changed the game somewhat, so to speak, hasn't it? That they can, that people can get organised very quickly and meet up very easily is no bad thing at all. It's just what they get up to is the problem. And to what extent is that the parents' fault that they haven't imbued their 16, 17-year-old, 15-year-old with the moral sense that, no, when you meet up, you don't go storming M&S and grabbing stuff off the shelves and creating havoc? Is that the parents' fault? 03456060973. Richard's in Brentford. Do you want to pick up on this Scott Mills story? Richard, hi.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I'm a former prosecutor, and it struck me as a bit unfair that here's somebody who's not even been charged, let alone acquitted, being hounded for something that happened years ago. So the starting point is no offence was committed. You know, that was the decision. So what I think it might be going on is there's probably a clause in his contract, Scott Mills, along the lines of bringing the organisation into disrepute. Mm-hmm. And in the current context, what's happened with Hugh Edwards and all the media interest in that side of things, if the facts came out that he was arrested in these circumstances, it would bring the organisation into disrepute.
BBC knew those facts in 2017-18 as has now been made the case.
Yeah, but he wasn't even acquitted, Tom. He wasn't even charged. So are we saying that somebody who isn't charged is guilty or something?
No, we're not. That's obviously not what we're saying. But we can't also say that the BBC... If the BBC had just become aware of this, oh my God, you'd had what happened, a question about that, then, okay, there's a decision to be made. But they were aware of it years and years ago and took the decision to keep him on air whilst this investigation got underway
after concluded. But isn't that absolutely fair and right that someone who's not even charged, I mean, a person who's acquitted ought to be in that same position. So I think that you can't criticise the BBC for saying this guy hasn't been charged.
Yeah, I agree.
We're not going to do anything. Absolutely fair. But if someone is now digging around in the context of what's happened to Hugh Edwards and all the other stuff, and they now present to the public these facts that Scott Mills was once arrested for, you know, potentially very serious matters... Mm-hmm. That would, as a matter of fact, bring the organisation into disrepute. Not that he did anything, but the fact that he was arrested and that became
known now. Well, quite possibly,
but
he presumably, or anybody, could fight that, you know, in court, could take him to court for it. But, Richard, the key thing here is the new information that the BBC says came to light. The new information that came to light wasn't the fact that he was questioned by police some years ago. There's something else, and we don't know what that something else is. And until we do know what that something else is, this is a particularly murky episode.
Yeah, but I think it does explain why the BBC acted how it did. It acted quite honourably in you know, not doing anything for someone who didn't do anything,
in terms of
the CPS and everybody else. So you can't criticise them for that.
No, I don't think one can. I think you're right. But that it is taking quite a long time to understand what the information is that the BBC sacked him on is odd, isn't it? I mean, it is a bit strange. A man has been sacked from his job, very high-profile individual, very high-profile job, one of the, you know, biggest news organisations in the world, gone, and it's days later and no one's got the foggiest about why, really. Richard, thank you for the call. Tom Swarbrick on LBC. Coming up.
We have a cheap power plan. We want to see the green taxes taken off bills and also stopping the rise in fuel duty.
The Tories say they will axe green taxes to stop the deindustrialisation of Britain and cut your bills. Anyone buying it? We'll speak to the Shadow Energy Secretary Claire Coutinho in a few moments. 8:46, news headlines on LBC. Here's Dominic.
President Trump says the United States is getting very close to completing its military objectives in Iran. Resident doctors in England are set to go on strike next week after a deadline set by the Prime Minister passed without agreement. And for the first time in more than half a century, four NASA astronauts are on their way to the moon. LBC weather, a sunny morning for many, but turning cloudy later. Some heavy rain for Northern Ireland and the west of Scotland later. A high of 13 degrees.
LBC Travel, I'm Joanne Webb. The M23 remains closed northbound between junctions 10 at Crawley and 9 at Gatwick Airport because of an accident. And there are severe delays on the approach. It's slow all the way back to junction 11 at Pease Pottage. Also, the delays continue on the A23 as drivers find an alternative route. The A40 is closed both ways between the Marylebone Flyover and the Northern Roundabout because of the ongoing bridge works. On the Underground, the Piccadilly Line can't run between Acton Town and Rayners Lane, and there's no service as well between the Heathrow terminals. Also on the Underground, there are severe delays on the Circle, District, Hammersmith and City and Victoria lines, and no service for Great Western Railway between Slough and Windsor and Eton.
LBC.
It's the cinematic event of the year. Critics are saying a stunning, breathtaking triumph of savings. It's 2-for-1 cinema tickets from Compasa Market in cinemas all year.
That sounds like a great movie.
Sergey, it's no movie. It's 2-for-1 offer on cinema tickets.
Oh, yeah. I knew that.
Get 2-for-1 cinema tickets every Tuesday or Wednesday with the Compasa Market app. The simplest way to save.
When you take out a qualifying product through Compasa Market, one membership per year, participating cinemas, 2 standard tickets only, cheap as free. T's and C's apply.
LBC.
Your time is valuable. Your perspective should be too. The Economist cuts through the noise with the stories that truly shape your world.
How can you believe that a new regime won't crush you just like the previous one?
Online scams are stranger than they've ever been.
When the world's turned upside down, know which way is up. Read, watch, or listen to The Economist.
Go all Irish to France with great low prices. With Irish Ferries, you can for less less. Irish Ferries, see you travel differently. T's and C's apply.
Turn up your taste buds with Dolmio Intensify pasta sauces. From mild creamy garlic and black pepper to bold smoky garlic and sun-dried tomato.
Whoa!
And spicy smoked paprika and chili.
Woo-hoo!
Try Dolmio Intensify pasta sauces with serious flavor. Dolmio, yeah!
3, 2, 1, 0% APR on an all-electric Mini Cooper. What was that, Luton? Handling is extraordinary. Centre of gravity so low. And it could be ours with a 15% deposit and 3-year term.
Okay, Luton, reroute me to the nearest Mini retailer now.
Land a new all-electric Mini Cooper with 0% APR. Report to your Mini retailer today. Mini UK is a credit broker. Ordered and delivered by 30th of June. PCP finance with Mini Financial Services. Subject to status. 18 plus. T's and C's apply. Mini.co.uk/Cooper.
At Wickes, the Home and Garden event is now on. Save on Dulux Standard 2.5-litre coloured emulsion. Was £24, now £16. Shop today. Terms apply.
Bring your pensions together into one easy-to-manage online plan with PensionBee. Because when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. When investing, your capital is at risk.
At Lidl, get everyone around the table this Easter with fresh veg from only 4p each. With cracking prices on British Swedes, parsnips, 1 kilogram of carrots and 2 kilograms of potatoes for 8p. And more. That's sure to put a spring in your step. Lidl, more to value. Subject to availability, selected stores, GB only.
Nick Ferrari at Breakfast with Tom Swarbrick on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
10 to 9 the time. A reminder, after the news at 9, we'll be joined by the chair of the BNA Resident Doctors Committee as they head out on strike again. We'll turn to the Shadow Energy Secretary Claire Coutinho in just a moment, but I've just been handed this. A statement by Hugh Edwards. Hugh Edwards says, much has been written and reported in the past week following Channel 5's one-sided account. Other opportunities will arise later this year for me to state my case and to challenge the misleading or fabricated claims made in recent coverage. A number of serious questions still remain to be answered, and not just by me. It will now take some time for me to produce my own account, and until then, I do not intend to comment any further. A statement there from the disgraced former BBC journalist Hugh Edwards, who says he is going to tell his story, but it will take some time. Ladies and gentlemen, the man should be in prison. Let us turn to the announcement from the Conservative Party, who today say that they will axe the carbon tax entirely to stop what they call the deindustrialisation of Britain and cut bills. Claire Coutinho is the Shadow Energy Secretary, Shadow Minister for Equalities and Conservative MP for East Surrey. Thank you very much indeed for coming on the programme. What does this carbon tax, to your mind, do that is stopping businesses from getting going?
So the carbon tax has been going up and up and up. And what you saw is that a third of our refineries shut last year. That means we're less able to make petrol, diesel, jet fuel, which I think is going to be an important thing in the years ahead as we're in this supply shock that we're facing. And the carbon tax for some refineries now is as much as their wage bill. Now, this is simply a tax that their competitors in other parts of the world are not facing. So what you're doing is driving British production out of existence, only to replace that with dirtier imports from abroad. That cannot make sense for climate. It doesn't make sense for the economy. It doesn't make sense for tax revenues or jobs either.
You call it Labour's carbon tax.
So it's gone up. Last year, it almost doubled under Labour because of their policies. They've made particular policies about aligning with the EU
recently taking away...
No, so we think it doesn't work at all anymore. And that's because when it was originally introduced, it originally was EU policy, so it came about when we were part of the EU. The idea was that countries around the world would adopt carbon taxes. But you don't have a carbon tax in the US. You don't have one in China, India or the Middle East. So all that is happening is British production is being undercut by these countries from around the world. And we can see that is clearly happening now, and it's happening at pace. And that's why we think you have to change course.
This was a tax brought in 2013 under a Conservative Prime Minister, David Cameron.
So this originated in the EU. So when we were part of the EU, you're right, we did do it. But me and Kemi Badenoch have been very clear that we think our party got things wrong when it came to net zero legislation in the past. And we have to look at the facts. So my view, you have to reject decarbonisation by deindustrialisation. Kemi Badenoch has been very clear about that as well. And that is what's happening at the moment. You can look at chemicals, for example. We've lost 60% of our chemicals capacity in recent years. We had the cleanest ammonia plant anywhere in Europe. That factory has shut down, and all we have done is imported more ammonia from other parts of the world with lower environmental standards. That cannot be right, and we have to change course.
How much did the carbon tax generate, and how is it going to be replaced?
So last year it generated £2.6 billion and we've identified funds. So we would scrap some of the outdated old wind subsidies, which see some wind farms get three times the market price for electricity. We've said we would take out heat pump subsidies as well, but we've fully funded it. But the truth is, Tom, if you look at this policy, because it is driving industry out of existence, you are losing tax. That's 60% of the chemicals capacity that we've lost. Those are factories which have shut down, which no longer pay tax into the exchange. So overall, this would be better for the economy because you'd be able to have thriving British industry here instead of relying on those imports from abroad.
Do you agree with Rachel Reeves's plan to allow for more drilling in the North Sea?
Well, I mean, of course I do. I just worry why it's taken her so long to get there. I mean, I've been arguing this for years, and the Labour Party called me a flat earther and a climate vandal at one point. And it's the same argument. The British North Sea gas has four times fewer emissions from the gas that we would import in its place. So whether it's climate or just simply the economy, jobs and tax revenues, of course we should be making the most of our own resources and things that we can make in Britain.
Can I ask you about one of the icons of the British pottery industry, Denby, who went into administration this week? It's been around for a very long time, over 200 years, 600 jobs. Part of its challenge is the high cost of gas. That was before the impact of the Iran war. We've seen job cuts at places like Wedgwood, similar issues at other places. Do you think the government should intervene to protect what is a heritage industry?
So if you look at all of these industries, ceramics is one of the areas that has actually been badly hit by the carbon tax. I'm not sure that affected Denby. I don't think they were big enough. But you have to look at these things in the round. Why are our companies becoming uncompetitive? And for someone like Denby and other countries, they've had increasing jobs taxes. For the bigger ones, they've had increasing carbon taxes. You know, energy prices have been going up and up and up. Mm. We have a cheap power plan that would cut energy costs for businesses and for households as well. We have to look at the things that are making British industry uncompetitive.
Do you think it was a mistake for Kemi Badenoch to suggest that Britain should have been more heavily involved in the war in Iran?
So what Kemi said was that we should defend our own bases. That was ultimately the position that Keir Starmer took. He just got there days later. That means for a period of time, you know, our military bases overseas were defended by other countries and not ourselves.
She didn't just say that we should defend our own bases. She said that we should get more involved with the Americans in bombing Iran.
No, she never said that we should join the offensive strike. You know,
by allowing them
to
use our bases.
We should have used let the US use our bases, but that's not the same as us joining the offensive strike. This is something which the Labour Party have tried to peddle. They talked about people joining the war. Nobody said we should join offensive strikes. We do think we should have done a better job of defending ourselves at the beginning of the war.
Appreciate your time. Thank you for coming on. Claire Coutinho is the Shadow Energy Secretary, Shadow Minister for Equalities and Conservative MP for East Surrey, 3 to 9. Kylie's in Manchester. Hi, Kylie.
Hi, how are you? You all right?
I'm very well, thank you very much indeed. This is on Keir Starmer's cozying up to Brussels, are we calling it, or just realism?
It's no brainer. We need to go back to EU. Brexit was a mistake. We're now seeing... I remember when Brexit happened, the amount of American corporations were lining up at Downing Street. It escalated the 0 hours. Brexit has literally really put the lives of the young people future in this country in a very bad place. And right now UK is in such a good place. The whole world is praising UK because of calm collective leadership of the war, and now we need to start building. We need to go back to EU. We need to, because our food chain is gone bad. We don't get in good quality food. We are paying, the hospitality industry is really suffering, and it employs the highest young people.
Kylie, the hospitality industry is suffering. Not necessarily just because we have left the European Union. The taxes that are being applied on hospitality are absolute madness. In Europe, they have, I think Ireland, VAT on hospitality to something like 10 or 12%.
Yes.
We've got the highest VAT on hospitality anywhere in Europe. That's not a decision that would be actually easier to make inside the European Union, perhaps.
So when we go back to EU, like you heard the shadow minister saying about the carbon tax, it's when they went back to, when they were with Europe, that happened. And I'm sure when we go back to Europe, our VAT will come down. And also, there will be...
Why?
You know,
why are you sure about that? What makes you sure about that?
Because if we go back to Europe, we will have to some of the rules which applies, we will have to follow. And also,
rules,
not only that, we are importing so much now. We have Brazil chicken in this country. It's because thanks to the Americans, we've got things coming from other parts of the world. It's time now that the UK starts producing their own things, getting things from Europe, which are, some of them are really good quality.
All right. Kylie, I appreciate the call. Thank you very much, Dee. Very clear where your sentiments lie. You're listening to Tom Swarbrick here on LBC. Coming up after the news at 9 o'clock...
I don't think that this dispute is resolved by headline generation, and I don't think that it's resolved by making threats.
The resident doctors choose to strike again, another 7 days starting next week.
The resident doctors committee's expectations are beyond reasonable and realistic.
The government is livid, pulling 1,000 training positions for those doctors.
Healthcare leaders up and down the country are very worried. They're planning hard, trying to maintain that patient safety.
The NHS has been struggling to recover since COVID. There is a greater degree of public satisfaction with it, but it is by no means back up on its feet. After the news, your chance to question Dr. Jack Fletcher, the chair of the BMA Resident Doctors Committee.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 9 o'clock, President Trump has promised to take Iran back to the Stone Age with relentless strikes over the next 2 to 3 weeks. In a televised address overnight, he said the US is getting very close to completing its military objectives. Since the speech, oil prices have risen by 7% to $107 a barrel. Former US senior advisor Jamil Jaffa has told LBC it seems unlikely all America's objectives will be met.
Will Iran be prevented from having a nuclear weapon forever in the future? Will it be prevented from being able to employ its terrorist proxies? And will its other forces have been significantly diminished? Their actual number of missiles, their number of drones, nuclear capabilities, as far as we know, that has not yet been destroyed. And I think those are much harder questions, and those will be hard objectives to meet in 2 to 3 weeks.
The Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper will host a virtual meeting of 35 nations later, focused on reopening the Strait of Hormuz.
Scott Mills has released his first statement since being sacked by the BBC of allegations about his personal conduct. He confirmed that he'd been the subject of a police investigation in 2016 into claims of historical sexual offences. The presenter says he fully cooperated with that case, which was later dropped due to a lack of evidence. Resident doctors in England are set to go on strike next week after a deadline set by the Prime Minister passed without agreement. Sir Keir Starmer gave the union, the BMA, 48 hours to call off walkouts or face losing extra training places. The six-day strike over jobs and pay is due to begin next Tuesday. The Chancellor appears to have opened divisions within Cabinet after backing drilling for oil and gas in the North Sea. Rachel Reeves has said that she's very happy to back exploration at Rosebank oilfield and Jackdaw gasfield. It's in contrast to the Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, who's cautioned against an over-reliance on new fossil fuel extraction. Tom asked the Government Minister, Kate Dearden, about the comments earlier on LBC.
On the existing licences, you know, we were clear in our manifesto about oil and gas being part of that mix for years to come. I've mentioned what's been challenged in the courts. We have to wait for that process to complete, where, as we said, we'd honour those existing licences, but really recognise what's happening in the courts. More broadly, we're absolutely committed to renewables and that homegrown energy. You've seen the investments that we have done in terms of renewables, more solar in the first 14 months from 14 years to the previous one.
And NASA's first crewed mission to the moon in more than 50 years has blasted off from Cape Canaveral in Florida. The Artemis 2 mission is expected to last 10 days. If successful, it'll take the four astronauts further into space than anyone has travelled before. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 51 at 10,313. The pound buys $1.32 and €1.14. LBC weather, a sunny start for many, but turning cloudy later. Some heavy rain developing for Northern Ireland and the west of Scotland. By the afternoon, a high of 13 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
So, you're geared up for this Making Tax Digital thing?
Sure, I just need some new mud boards, bag of cavity tyres and a couple of lintels.
Hey, MTD, mate, digital taxes.
Mm-hmm, it's an extension down Station Road on the corner.
Dave, digital taxes, mate.
Yeah, I probably will need some 2x4s. I want to go take the van in for a new fan belt, squeaky.
Hey, Making Tax Digital, Dave.
Avoiding MTD. Sage makes tax simpler for sole traders. Search Sage MTD to get your free software today.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation. Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick.
Morning to you. 4 minutes past nine the time on Thursday, April the 2nd. Tom Swarbrick here on LBC, where for the next half an hour we are in the company of Dr. Jack Fletcher, the chair of the BMA Resident Doctors Committee, who are, as I'm sure you are now aware, on strike again from next week. The government now has withdrawn an offer of creating 1,000 more doctor training posts in England after the British Medical Association refused to call off a six-day strike next week. The extra posts were part of a wider package of measures put forward by ministers earlier this year to resolve that long-running dispute with resident doctors, formerly known, of course, as junior doctors. Dr. Jack Fletcher is with us in the studio. Thank you very much indeed for coming in. Clearly a very busy time.
Good morning.
Lots and lots of people want to get on the radio about this and ask you some questions about what on earth is going on. So let's get straight to it. John is in Cowbridge to kick us off. Morning, John.
Good morning, Tom.
You're through to Dr. Fletcher.
Hello, Dr. Fletcher. I'd like to ask a question surrounding why you think it's appropriate to ask for far more than other people in the private public sector are currently able to achieve. At a time of public sector pay restraint, why you're not prepared to put the offer that the Health Secretary, I believe, has made in good faith to you, to your members? Why is there just a small group of individuals who are making a decision on behalf of everyone and not putting the decision to members?
Thanks, John. So there's two questions there, and I'll sort of take them in turn if that's all right. So the first one was just around the pay of resident doctors and doctors versus the rest of the public sector and the rest of the private sector. And I think we can't look at this in isolation at any sort of single point in time. We have to look at this over a period of time. So we look at this from 2008 because that was an actual point in time that resident doctors were paid an amount of money. we have seen that that amount of money over time has essentially eroded and has been degraded over successive years.
Mm-hmm.
What we're asking for is essentially the restoration of that value, not in one go. Nobody's ever asked for anything overnight. We recognise that the start of that journey, and I use the word journey in the same way the health secretary described it as a journey, we started that journey in 2024. However, this deal would essentially risk, very real risk, baking in further real terms pay erosion, which is why it's not acceptable to us.
How do you know it's not acceptable to you? You haven't put it to your members?
So we hear this quite a lot, and I was just about to take John's second question around sort of how we operate in this regard. You know, we were challenged several times in October, and then we were challenged several times in November and several times in December about putting things to members. The government and various folks in the media were very, very, very insistent that resident doctors would accept the deal that was put to them in December. And actually, in 72 hours, we had 65% of resident doctors polled overwhelmingly reject that offer by 83%. So we've heard this rhetoric several times before. We've been really clear to the government about what would make this work and what would make this work for our members. Our committee is full. There's a 50 plus of them who represent resident doctors from across England. They're all working resident doctors. A large majority of them will be working today on wards, in clinics, and those people make decisions because they're directly elected by our members, and it doesn't meet the threshold to put it to our members.
John, appreciate the question. You pick a date in time as being 2008. That's the point at which you start the paper. Can I pick a date, which is 2020? Since 2020, the average cash pay of a resident doctor has increased by 33%. That's down in part to the strength of the union and the strike action that has been taken. Is that not enough? Is that not a good start to that journey that you say that you're on? 33%.
So you've picked 2020,
yeah.
but ultimately that is a point in time, and I recognise that in the same way 2008 is a point in time. However, doctors were paid and valued that amount in 2008. That is not a made-up number. That is not a random amount. Doctors were actually paid and valued at that level in 2008. I therefore think if we then had a decade-plus worth of real-terms pay cuts successively under consecutive governments, I don't think it's unreasonable to say, actually, can we get back to that level? We don't have to do it in one go. However,
isn't that what's happening?
However,
I mean, that is literally what is happening.
No, it's not. And this pay deal that was put forward by a number of metrics of inflation, given what we expect to happen in the next few months with the wider economic situation, we expect this to bake in real terms pay cuts over not just this year, but potentially future years as well, which is clearly not acceptable against a backdrop of 10 plus years of further real terms pay cuts.
Lance is in Bristol. Hi, Lance.
Good morning, Tom. Nice to speak to you again. I've been a consultant now for 33 years and as a junior doctor for 13 years, when we were resident, I was working between 90 and 120 hours a week. My question is, how is the BMA going to get the public back on side?
Thanks, Lance. And obviously, we've got it's an interesting time at the BMA, given the Consultants Committee are also launching, and they don't feel that they are being fairly valued by the government, and they've launched their own ballot for industrial action. But specifically on the question around public support, so I work in acute medicine, and when I speak to people who are sat in our unit for hours and hours and hours and hours because there aren't enough doctors, when we are scrambling around at the last minute for cover, and yet we are turning away tens of thousands of resident doctors in the NHS, patients are genuinely shocked by that.
Mm-hmm.
When we have, I think by the NHS's own statistics, about 54,000 patients who were treated in A&E for more than 12 hours in February. That was a non-strike month, and we are still seeing thousands of patients being managed in corridors, waiting 12 hours. But yet at the same time, last year we turned away 13 fully qualified resident doctors for every single A&E training job. That is clearly
ridiculous. You've just turned
ridiculous.
Down. The government have just taken off the table 1,000 new training posts.
Yeah, so we didn't turn that down. The government chose to remove
yes.
those, and that is bad for doctors, and it's also bad for patients, because actually when the government is presiding over an epidemic of corridor care, when people are trying to get through to their GPs this morning and I'm greeted by hold music because there aren't enough GPs, and the government are then threatening to remove further jobs for doctors and progression when we need more specialists.
So it's good for
GPs.
Everyone that these 1,000 training places stay, and yet you won't put this deal to your members.
It's the government's choice to remove those training places.
And it's your choice not to put it to your members.
We have decided that it does not meet the threshold to put this to our members.
How can you make that decision?
And we are confident that that members would not accept this, in the same way that people asked us to do this in December. People were confident that members would accept it.
Well, let's
and
prove
actually
it. Let's
they were,
do it.
They were wrong.
Let's make it happen. You can make it happen today. We're going to put this to our members. We're going to prove that we're right to make the decision on their behalf that they'll reject this.
So in terms of, let's just talk about the mechanics of putting something to our membership. So the reason why the government keep insisting on putting things to members is because they want us to tie ourselves into a 6 weeks referendum period. And that's specifically what they've asked for. Mm-hmm. And yet in this country, due to trade union laws, which have just recently changed, but our current mandate for industrial action was given to us by tens of thousands of resident mm-hmm. doctors mm-hmm. up and down this country. That only lasts for 6 months. So if every time the government came forward with an offer, we spend 6 weeks repeatedly putting it to members, that's a great negotiating tactic and a great way for the government to burn down that mandate. The government have set the terms, that's their terms. So, you know, I think it's also worth recognising, though, that the Resident Doctors Committee are directly elected to represent resident doctors on the shop floor.
Well, don't put anything to members, then. What's the point of putting anything to... What's the point of asking members for a ballot for potential strike action? You just make the decision.
So I think... The Resident Doctors Committee is made up of resident doctors who are working with colleagues. They are doctors on the shop floor. They aren't union bureaucrats. They are, as we've been accused of being before, mm-hmm. they are resident doctors who are working 40, 50, 60, 70-hour weeks, and they are directly elected by the resident doctors of our membership, and that therefore they are representative, and I don't think it's unreasonable to ask their opinion about whether or not they think their colleagues and members would accept this deal.
You say that... The new pay offer would be eroded by inflation. Johnny in Essex says this. The pay deal was a 3.5% increase. Inflation is at 3%. Where's the erosion?
So so there's a couple of things there. So there's the pay review body, the DDRB, and that recommended 3.5%. Mm-hmm. Now, that is essentially the government have chosen to accept that in the same mm-hmm. way they've chosen to accept other public sector pay review body awards. So that's one aspect of it. But in reality, the government, what they did was, we were talking about additional investment into the way that doctors progress through their career, and essentially so that we can get doctors progressing through their career yep. slightly more quickly, but also then getting paid for the complex surgeries that they'll then go on to do, etc., etc. That pay rise that we were talking about, which was the additional investment, right at the last minute, was reduced and then stretched over 3 years. Now, that essentially equates to a roughly 1%. Now, in terms of the inflation question, I think everyone's watching what's going on in the Middle East and yes. everyone's watching what's going on elsewhere in the world. So actually, we're talking about a pay award that starts now, as of yesterday, and lasts for the next 12 months. When we're looking down the
3.5%.
When we're looking down the barrel of inflation skyrocketing, as is predicted, and we've had...
what inflation's going to be, and no one does. No one knows what inflation's going to be. Inflation currently is 3%. They can only award based on current levels of inflation. You are awarded an above-inflation pay rise of 3.5%, not much more, but it's above inflation. What's the issue? Sorry, maybe I'm hard of thinking here, but the inflation is at 3%. You've been awarded 3.5%, yet you're saying inflation is the problem.
So it depends how you measure inflation on top of that, and we're getting into the statistical part here, but ultimately...
See, you're going for RPI inflation.
We are.
Why?
Because the measure of inflation you've just quoted does not include owner-occupier housing costs, and crucially, student loans
yes.
are tied to RPI. So the government accepts... And we accept that RPI is a valid measure of inflation when we're charging 7, 8, 9% uh-huh. on student loans. But when it comes to actually paying people, the government conveniently neglects that.
So the processes of the BMA not only stop you from putting this to your members because it would overrun your ballot for strike action, it also means that the inflation that you're measuring this by is a measure of inflation that no one else, you're right, say other than the government uses for student loans, but no one else uses.
That's not true. And, you know, you talk about processes in the BMA. We're talking about democratic processes. Each individual representative on our committee has been directly elected with their own mandate. We've passed another ballot for industrial action, and that's no mean feat. We passed another ballot for industrial action nationally a couple of months ago. We were hoping not to use it, but members have said that they want a reversal of the real terms pay cuts that they faced, and this deal does not represent that, and therefore I do not think it's unreasonable to say members asked us for this, and actually this doesn't represent this, and therefore no.
Daniel's in Golders Green. Daniel.
Good morning, Tom, and good morning, Doctor.
Hello.
Dr. Fletcher, I was just wondering, given that resident doctors have enjoyed a 33% pay rise, do you believe it's hypocritical that the BMA's own staff have only been offered a 2.75% pay rise, and do you believe that they also deserve fair pay?
Thanks, Daniel. So there's a couple of things there. The first one is, and I will say this, I have nothing to do with setting the rate of pay for the BMA staff in the same way that I've got absolutely nothing to do with setting the rate of pay for teachers, nurses, those in the private sector. I'm here to talk about resident doctor pay, and I'm here representing resident doctors. That said, I think any group of workers who have faced real terms pay erosion, whether it be resident doctors, consultants, nurses, teachers, all BMA staff, I think, have a very real and credible argument to ask for a reversal of that erosion.
Do you so the BMA staff are striking, about 500 of them, over their own pay dispute. Do you back BMA staff in going on strike over this pay issue?
I was stood on the picket line with BMA staff last week.
Because they were offered a below inflation at 3%, they were offered a below inflation pay rise. So you can see how it might seem a little hypocritical that BMA staff are being offered a below inflation pay rise. BMA doctors' union are taking their resident doctors out on strike when they've been offered an above inflation pay rise.
Again, I stand in solidarity with any group of workers, whether they're in the private sector, the public sector, who have faced real terms pay erosion and who are seeking for a reversal of that. I think that's very reasonable in the same way that we're asking for that. And I stood in solidarity on a picket line with BMA staff last week.
Matt's in Manchester. Hi, Matt.
Hi there. Thanks for having me. Thanks, Jack, for what you're doing. I'm a doctor in Manchester. I just wondered what your thoughts were on Sir Jim Mackey's comments this morning in the HSJ, where he says that they're going to reduce reliance on doctors as a result of these strikes going forward. I mean, how can doctors possibly be so important and indispensable to patient care that they cannot and should not strike if the government's going forward anyway and moving away from doctor-led care?
Thanks, Matt. So it's certainly interesting comments, and they were obviously the HSJ took those comments and has sort of presented them in a specific way. However, I do think that we've seen several articles from the HSJ and several moves by
Health
NHS England. The Health Service Journal and also NHS England in recent years to move away from doctor-led care. But ultimately what we've seen by NHS England's own admission is that we've got more people in the NHS than ever before, and yet productivity is lower than it ever was. So that workforce experiment is clearly not working, and I think any propagation of it is clearly for the birds, frankly, given we've gone from a model which had lots of doctor-led care, and then we've moved away from that model, which I don't believe is right. However, I think, to propagate that model when we've got productivity problems, more people than ever before, is clearly not an argument that I think is tenable.
The Prime Minister says they think they can cover probably about 95%. Of what it was that resident doctors were covering whilst you're on strike. So there will be some damage done to the NHS, but not huge amounts of damage. Do you accept that your strikes are having limited effect as they become more and more frequent?
So in terms of industrial action, you know, I genuinely mean this. I think talks have been constructive over the last few months, and none of us, I don't think, wanted to end up in this situation where we were taking further industrial action in 2026.
Could have asked your membership.
We all wanted to get to a deal. However, at the last minute, when the government reduces the amount of investment that they were talking about and then stretches it over a number of years, that clearly is not a fair or reasonable negotiating tactic. To that end, we've seen increasing participation in industrial action in November and then again in December. There are several factors which influence whether or not doctors take industrial action. We're encouraging all resident doctors in England to take industrial action. However, we are also recognising that, you know, patients who are listening this morning who might have care rescheduled next week or has care disrupted by these strikes, we're genuinely very regrettable for that. We don't want to do this. And I know people say that, yes, you do, because you're going out. We do not want to do this. I've made that very clear several times. We will postpone the action if the government returns to the table, gives us a credible offer.
And a credible offer would start with...
That is the best route out of this. I don't think the route out of this is by threatening to take jobs off the table, which is ultimate, which is bad for doctors, but ultimately bad for patients.
So returning to the table would be helped by the unwinding of the stretching of the deal that the government did, you say, at the last minute?
So the government have done a couple of things. They've reduced the amount of investment and then stretched what was left over a number of years, which clearly is not credible.
What they reduced it from
them
to?
There's also a number of things in there which, you know, we're talking about these jobs, which are essentially, a number of them are converted jobs rather than new jobs.
Yep.
And there are obviously doctors who have sat here, who have sat there this morning, who have been told in the last few weeks that their contracts are going to come to an end. And we've then got the government playing what sounds like the hokey-cokey, where they're putting something on the table and then three hours later, taking it off the table, issuing threats. I don't think that's any way to treat a workforce, let alone a workforce who is responsible for
care. What was the investment that they were going to put in versus what they, at the last minute, said they were?
So I'm not going to negotiate live on air. However... The investment was moved down and then it was stretched, and that we ultimately spent a week or two trying to reverse that. The government repeatedly said no, and that's why we felt like we had no choice but to call further industrial action. And just to be really clear, the government have made it explicit that they will not negotiate whilst strikes are called. That is their decision. Mm-hmm. The BMA has not walked away from the table. If the government came to us with an offer that was credible, I would meet the government at any point with my team today, tomorrow, over the bank holiday weekend, before industrial action, during industrial action, if it happens, or after industrial action, to get this result.
An Easter miracle. Chris is in Preston. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Sorry, I forgot your name. But hello, Dr. Fletcher. So I've got a three-part question. One, so obviously when the NHS was created, Bevan, you know, famously said we had to stuff doctors' mouths with gold. Which leads me on to my second part, is how do we know that doctors weren't just overpaid in 2008? You know, and that this is just a natural course correction, as, you know, more people take up roles, it's less demand, there's more people out there doing the job, so it comes at a lesser cost. And then also, you know, how would this, you know, if you want this pay rise, can we cut your 23.7% employer pension, which is paid by the government?
So there's a couple of things there. So firstly, I don't think anyone's asking for gold at all in this. What we're asking for is essentially, the restoration of that lost value. I think what is important to contextualise that question is when we look at the lost value of doctors, whether it's residents, consultants, SAS colleagues or GPs, we have seen the largest pay erosion in the public sector during the period that we're referring to. Now, residents, like I've said several times, have had a good start to the reversal of those pay cuts in 2024. Nobody is denying that. I'm not denying that. None of my colleagues are. However, when there is such a gap in terms of the value of the work that we do compared to the private sector, compared to elsewhere in the public sector, and I'm not for a second saying that other workers in the public sector or other worker groups in the NHS shouldn't be pursuing their lost pay erosion, but when there's such a gap between doctors and the rest of the public sector...
How do you measure that gap?
I think that is clearly an outlier.
All right, so how are we measuring the gap between the work the junior doctors are doing in other areas of the public sector?
So when we look at pay from 2008 to now and the lost value of that pay, yes, when we compare it with other staff groups, then resident doctors and consultants in particular have lost out the most.
Well,
in
you
comparison.
Say that. So you say there's a 21% gap between the 2008 pay and the 2026 pay. But again, you use a much higher rate of inflation to calculate that. The Nuffield Trust say that there is a gap, but it's only 4%.
So there's a couple of things there. The first one is, regardless of which figures you use, there is a gap.
Yep.
There is a gap.
I think everyone accepts there has a gap.
Regardless of which figures you use. Now, since 2008, you know, the government chose to continue eroding doctors' pay since 2008. Uh-huh. They chose to change student loans twice. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And both of those times they continued to use RPI. It affects doctors more from a social mobility point of view, but two, because doctors are doctors have 4, 5, 6 years six-year degrees, and therefore the loans that you get out the other out of the other end are huge. And if you are the first person in your family to go to university, like some of my colleagues are, they aren't supported by their parents, and therefore when you compound
so
that across
you get
6 years,
another 21%.
That's huge.
Unless you get another 21% pay restoration, this is going to keep happening. This cycle of strike action from resident doctors will keep happening.
All we're asking for is a journey of how we get back that lost value. That's all
we're
asking for.
You're on the journey. This is the journey. Welcome to the journey. You have had a 33% average cash pay increase since 2020. The total value, including pension, which, as the caller pointed out, is a 23.7% employee pension contribution. The total value of an first year resident doctor is £48,000. Now, we can argue about whether that's a lot, whether that's not enough, but you're on the journey.
So there's a couple of things there. You know, we keep talking about this 33% cash increase, but let's just contextualise that against inflation. So the government have came out and said 35%. Yes, if you put years together, you will get larger numbers if you compound that over a number of years. What we're talking about is inflation, which the government conveniently deliberately ignore, and that is not included in that number. So between January 2022... January 2026, inflation was 28% by our maths. So yes, the numbers do look big. Even by CPI, CPIH, the numbers do look big when you put them all together. That's obvious because you're just adding four numbers together in the same way the government have added them and not looked at the real terms value of that.
Richard's in Upminster. Richard.
Oh, hi, Tom. I just think I wake up on a Thursday morning and I'm hearing a doctor. I think you guys need your heads knocking together. The doctors, the politicians, the NHS. You need to remember that you are accountable to the population of this country. So you need to. Negotiations are about getting a result, not arguing about stuff. So your job is to sit down and work together and make sure that you create an NHS. You know, you've got a 10-year plan. So you need to focus on that and how maybe you could save money and maybe other ways, rather than arguing about a failed system that's not really working very well. So my message to you is, you need to stop arguing with each other, and we need to hold you accountable. We're not quite sure how, but we want you to sort this out.
Thanks, Richard. I think we completely agree that the way out of this is to sit down and work together to get out of this. And what is not the way in which to get out of this is not by refusing to move, despite the fact that you've shrunk the investment and stretched it, and then repeatedly said no, and then to go out and make threats about removing jobs off the table. That is clearly not the way out of this. We have said consistently, and I've said to the Secretary of State, I've said to the negotiating team on the other side, that I am very, very, very keen to get these disputes settled. However, that has to be with a credible offer that fixes the jobs crisis as well as the long-term pay erosion. And I'm more than happy, even at this late stage, despite the fact that the government are refusing to negotiate whilst strike action is there, I'm more than happy to sit down with them today, all day, all day tomorrow, across the weekend, and try and find a way out of this.
Richard, thank you. We've only got a minute or so left. Lucy's in Muswell Hill. Lucy.
Good morning, Dr. Fletcher. Good morning, Tom. Good morning. Thank you for taking the call. My question is quite simple. I noticed that this morning the government are threatening to take away the 1,000 training spaces. My daughter is a resident doctor. She's completed her F1, F2. She's been working as a locum, unable to secure a training space. Could you not lobby the government for more training spaces and for priority to be given to UK homegrown students rather than open to the whole world, as in keeping with other countries?
Thanks, Lucy. And I think your daughter is one of many tens of thousands who are in a very similar situation, and we hear this quite commonly now. So just a couple of things. We've talked about talks being constructive. We recognise that there has been progress, and we came very close to something, but we recognise that there has been progress on a number of fronts. So, for example, the government legislated earlier this year and immediately commenced the Act, once it passed through Parliament, to prioritise UK graduates as well as a few other graduates from other countries, to essentially make sure that doctors who are trained in this system essentially have a better chance of getting a job as a doctor in the system, which I think we think is fair and reasonable. What we do need to do, though, is recognise that there are also thousands of doctors in our NHS who have contributed significant amounts who haven't qualified in the UK, and we do need to make sure that those doctors have job security and aren't having rugs from pulled under them in the way that a lot of employers
do. Well, the rug has just been pulled from.
In the way that employers do pull the rug from under people across the country. And the other thing to recognise is, as part of these talks, we have been pushing for more training places, because it's not just good for doctors, yep. It's good for the NHS.
And they've just been pulled.
We want more specialists, we need more GPs, we need more A&E doctors when we're turning away tens of thousands of them and we're treating patients in corridors. We need more surgeons to get the waiting list down. We need more anaesthetists to facilitate that.
Yep.
And yet the government is making a political choice to remove those 1,000 training places. We will continue to push for more training places, as well as other protections for doctors like your daughter, who are essentially in what is now a giant gig economy, which is essentially what happens after the second year that you've qualified and you fall into this giant bottleneck where yep. You've got this year 40,000 resident doctors applying for 10,000 jobs. That's clearly not sustainable.
Well, the government have said no to these job offers, these training places. Disaster for people. You negotiated getting those new training places, or at least converting some other jobs into those training places. That has now been pulled. Part of the reason is because you continue to say no to the government about putting this to your members. Just do it. Put it to your members, take the 6 weeks, see what happens, get another mandate to strike if needs be. I'm sure you'll get one from the membership. It is insane to hold to ransom Lucy's daughter's career on the back of your 50 members just decided amongst themselves, actually, no, this isn't going to be acceptable. Come on, Dr. Fletcher, you can do this.
So there's a couple of things there. You know, we were asked this question, and we've been asked this several times before. Put it to your members, put it to your members. We did that in December. We said that we wouldn't pass members. Members agreed with us,
yep.
Overwhelmingly agreed with us, and we're saying the same thing again this time. This will not... We will be asking members to vote for what are likely to be baked in real terms pay cuts, as well as a load of other stuff which to do with jobs, which is just half baked. We think progress has been made, and we are absolutely willing to put offers to our members if we think they're substantial enough, if we think they're credible. That is not a problem, but this offer is not it, and threatening to remove 1,000 jobs is bad for doctors and is bad for patients.
Percentage chance of you seeing Wes Streeting over the course of the Easter holidays?
I will happily meet the government, the Secretary of State, whoever wants to meet with us to try and find a way out of this, but ultimately there has to be an improvement to that offer.
Grateful for your time. Thank you very much, Steve, for coming in. Dr. Jack Fletcher is chair of the BMA Resident Doctors Committee. You're listening to LBC. Tom Swarbrick here, 9:33. Let's get some headlines. Dominic Ellis.
The chair of the BMA Resident Doctors Committee has told LBC that he's happily will continue talks with ministers over the weekend, despite planned strike action for next week. The government has this morning withdrawn an offer to create 1,000 extra training places after the BMA failed to call off walkouts next week. President Trump says the United States is getting very close to completing its military objectives in Iran. In a televised address, he said America would subject the country to another 2 to 3 weeks of extremely hard strikes. And NASA's first crewed mission to the moon in more than 50 years has blasted off from Cape Canaveral in Florida. Artemis 2 is due to take the crew further into space than anyone has gone before. LBC weather, a sunny morning for many, but turning cloudy later. Some heavy rain for Northern Ireland and the west of Scotland by the afternoon. A high of 13 degrees.
This is LBC.
This time last year, Hassan was working in sales and spent his evenings gaming. Now, he's working as a prison officer.
You know what's going to happen, it's not worth it. Let's just go in there.
He's tackled cell fires, got through to some of the most challenging prisoners, and helped support their rehabilitation. He's done things he once thought he was never capable of, but he still loves his gaming. An extraordinary job done by someone like you. Search prison jobs now.
It's hard to concentrate when you're worried about your health. It can feel like there's a wall between you and the rest of the world. Like you can't be fully present.
Hello, AXA Health. How can I help?
At AXA Health Insurance, we build our teams with people who care. So when you need us, we're here to support you. For cover that cares, search AXA Health Insurance. Pre-existing conditions are not covered.
One of the best things about a holiday with Saga is your chauffeur, who'll pick you up and drive you to your departure point.
Whether you're river cruising along the Rhine past storybook castles or uncovering centuries of history on a tour of Japan. Even better, they'll pick you up and drive you home again afterwards. 2026 season now on sale. Search Saga Holidays. Experience is everything. Nationwide chauffeur service available on UK mainland. Full terms apply. Over 50s only.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
9.36 the time, Tom Swarbrick here on LBC. We've just spent half an hour in the company of Dr. Jack Fletcher, the chair of the BMA Resident Doctors Committee, as they once again lead their members out on strike next week for 6 days. I take the point about process of 6 weeks of putting it to membership, but it does feel like 50 people deciding on behalf of the entire organisation know this isn't going to satisfy it. Put it to them, and then we got an answer. Paddy's in Bermondsey. Paddy, your thoughts on what you've heard from the doctor there? Do you think they're right in going out this time?
Oh, no, I don't. I mean, I'll back them 100% junior doctors all day, but I think now with, what was it, 33% they've had already?
Yes. Yeah, since 2020.
I think it's outrageous to go on more strikes. I mean, my wife's a midwife, and right, they've just had their overtime rate cut. So I don't see how junior doctors are a lot more important than a midwife to be getting all this extra money, because, as I say, like the night shifts that they do now, midwives from 8 at night to 8 in the morning, where they used to get a little bit extra on top, have just been slashed from £45 up to £50 a shift. So you've got all these midwives that are working just as hard as these junior doctors. I mean, my wife goes to work sometimes at 8 in the morning and she don't have her first break till 5 o'clock at night.
Yeah, it's a tough job.
So it's a tough job. You do it for the love. You don't do it for the money. But to get them all out on the picket lines again for more money, it's getting to the point now where I'm not feeling sorry for them at all.
They get, I'm reading it here, 37% enhancement for unsocial hours, additional weekend pay that can amount to £3,700, flat rate for being on call of about £3,000 if you're a first year one, and of course pay for hours worked beyond a 40-hour week, which seems reasonable. If you work beyond your hours, you should get paid for it.
The poor little sods.
Well, you want, and Paddy, you will know because your wife's a midwife, you will want people who are doing those jobs in the NHS to be paid.
Yeah, accordingly.
The value that they are bringing.
But yeah, I don't think it's right that they are slashing the midwife's pay and giving it to junior doctors. I mean, these midwives that do all these like 4 or 5 years of training, they still have to pay out tens of thousands in all the bursaries that they've had. So they're in just as a bad state as them. So why should the junior doctors be on more money? I don't get it. I really wish I would have spoke to him, but yeah, obviously he's gone.
Yeah, sorry. The bit that got to me is the rather selective and convenient use of measures of inflation. Now, I know this is a bit in the weeds.
Yeah, but it's not the inflation that we all use, is it?
Well, quite. And I take his point about they use it on student loans. Yes, that's why it's a complete scandal. So it seems a little hypocritical to then use the same measure when applying to your pay increases to say it's nowhere near enough.
Yeah, I mean, when I used to drive past St Thomas's Hospital and that, and they was all standing outside, I'd give them a few toots and they'll wave their arms. I won't be giving no more beeps when I drive past them, mate. That ain't happening.
Paddy, I appreciate the call. Thank you very much indeed. Good luck to your good lady. 03456060973, the number. Ian, I'll come to your call in just a few moments. But at 9.39, let's go from the hospital to the classroom.
I love AI. Do you use AI? Do you know ChatGPT? I love ChatGPT.
Artificial intelligence is killing pupils' critical thinking and has dampened their thirst for knowledge, according to the National Education Union, who have done a survey which comes amid a debate over how much pupils should be allowed to use AI. Some 66% of secondary school staff think critical thinking has declined due to tools such as ChatGPT. Daniel Kabadi is the General Secretary of the National Education Union, who conducted this survey of secondary school teachers in England. Thank you very much indeed for coming on the programme.
Good morning.
What do we mean by critical thinking skills?
You know, their cognitive development, their ability to interpret the world and present their work to teachers. There's a real issue at the moment around AI and what it means for teaching and learning. What does it mean for teaching and learning when a 14-year-old can go on ChatGPT and ask it to write them an essay on William Shakespeare in a 14-year-old style? You know, there's been a cognitive displacement happening, And we're really concerned about it. And it's not just us. In fact, Brookings in America conducted some research about this and are also worried about cognitive offloading and in turn cognitive decline in young people because of it.
For cognitive decline, see cheating at homework, which is made obviously much, much easier. My God, it's made fantastically easy by ChatGPT and Gemini and others.
Say that again, sorry.
That the cheating at homework, that the ability to do it, get the computer to do it for you is so much easier.
That's right.
What's the way around it for teachers? They have to check whether or not that bit of writing has gone through an AI machine.
Well, yeah, that's right. They have to. They often do check those sorts of things. But the real fundamental problem, I think, actually, is that we are going to have to really change how we educate young people. Skills like creativity, critical thinking skills are going to really matter much more in the future.
And that means teaching young people what to ask the large language model in order to produce the answer that they're looking for.
Well, primarily, yes, teaching children how to fundamentally think for themselves rather than, to critically engage with the world around them, interpret sources, so that they can develop as well-rounded human beings.
Do you think AI should be used at all in schools?
So I think there's a role for artificial intelligence and education technology more broadly, but there are key questions for the profession and for education. Who owns it? Who controls it? Whose interest it operates in really do matter. We live in a world where we have big technology companies who have an interest in education. For example, Elon Musk, for example, thinks education is something that can be gamified so that you could essentially do away with the role of the teacher and teach children the basic skills of life through algorithm. You know, what is education and what does it mean is a real key question. We think that artificial intelligence could be used to allow space for teachers to focus on educating children about what makes us human. That would be a good direction of travel.
Do you think teachers should be able to work a four-day week?
I think teachers have I know teachers are working more unpaid overtime than any other profession. I know that in the United Kingdom and in England and Wales specifically, we have some of the highest contact time in the OECD in the developed world. I would like to see teachers have much more space to be able to plan creative lessons for their young people.
Including potentially out of the classroom, out of school, on a Wednesday or a Thursday, whatever, to do that at home?
Well, what I would like to see is teachers have 20% planning and planning preparation and assessment time, PPPA, we call it. That isn't a four-day week. That is just allowing teachers some time to be able to plan and prepare their lessons. The reality is, at the moment, particularly for women with childcare responsibilities, many of them are dropping a day a week anyway. So they're essentially going part-time to work full-time so that they can have some time with their family at the weekend. If we are going to deal with the recruitment and retention crisis, then we have to really deal with the issue of workload, working hours and work intensity.
Just while I have you, can I ask you about what we learnt in January, that the NEU has hired a barrister to investigate accusations that it has created, and I'm quoting here, a hostile environment for its Jewish members. Mm. Yeah. The investigation was reportedly launched more than a year ago. Has it concluded? Yeah. What has it found?
It's concluded, and I've published the key conclusions already. The full report will be published shortly, but you are correct. I asked Karen Monaghan KC to conduct an independent investigation and review into our union. She concluded we are a progressive union built on, with a progressive values, and made a series of recommendations for us to build on that. She did not find a culture of or any systemic racism, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, or misogyny. But she has made recommendations to ensure that we can be the best union that we possibly can be.
What recommendations would those be?
Well, they will be published in due course. But for example, you know, a policy on having healthy debate, which would be good for any union to have.
A healthy debate, meaning what?
You know, that we have, you know, a policy to ensure that debate is had in solidarity and with respect in the trade union. I think that's a very good thing for all trade unions to have.
Solidarity with the Jewish community, for one.
Well, solidarity with each other. You know, she's
including
very clear.
The Jewish
she
community,
fight.
I guess, because you have Jewish members who have accused you of the NEU rather than you individually, of institutional anti-Semitism.
And we and Karen Monaghan Casey, an EHRC accredited King's Counsel, found that we are not institutionally anti-Semitic. She found that, not the NEU itself, an independent person. What I want to see is our trade union be the best possible trade union, and that's why I asked her to conduct that sort of review. And in fact, I would recommend her to any institution, including media organisations, so that she could conduct a similar review, because it's important that big organisations like mine and others ensure that they are the best place to fill members and for employees.
Daniel Kabades, the General Secretary of the National Education Union, who conducted this survey of secondary school teachers about AI killing pupils' critical thinking. Do you agree? 03456060973. More of your calls in a few moments. 9:47, news headlines now. Dominic Ellis.
The chair of the BMA Resident Doctors Committee has told LBC he will happily resume pay talks with ministers over the Easter weekend, despite planned strike action for next week in England. President Trump has promised to take Iran back to the Stone Age with relentless strikes over the next 2 to 3 weeks. And NASA's first crewed mission to the moon in more than 50 years has blasted off from Cape Canaveral in Florida. LBC weather, a sunny morning for many but turning cloudy later, some heavy rain for Northern Ireland and the west of Scotland, a high of 13 degrees.
LBC Travel, I'm Joanne Webb. The M23 remains closed northbound between junctions 10 at Crawley and 9 at Gatwick Airport because of the ongoing investigation. Severe delays back past junction 11 at Pease Pottage and on the surrounding routes, especially through Crawley. One lane's closed on the M25 clockwise just before the QE2 bridge. It's because a car has broken down. And delays continue on the M3 northbound up to junction 3 at Lightwater, and that's where a car has broken down. On the train, southern services remain delayed between Redhill and Tunbridge following a signal failure. And on the underground, the Piccadilly line can't run between the Heathrow terminals, and there are severe delays between Acton Town and Uxbridge.
Coming up at 10 on LBC, James O'Brien.
Do you indulge the madness by asking the question, what happens if the United States leaves NATO? And Keir Starmer's warm words about the EU, do you like them?
James O'Brien at 10. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
Right, that's it. Come on, lights out. You've got a test tomorrow.
Just 2 minutes. I'm about to reach the next level.
It's going off now.
Yeah, whatever.
Let's see. Where's the app? Oh, here it is. Ha.
What? How?
Oh, no. You're out. Better luck next time.
Mum!
It's game over for late nights on school nights. EE Wi-Fi controls help you get them off the Wi-Fi and into bed. More parents are choosing EE Broadband, the UK's fastest growing broadband provider.
To verify, see ee.co.uk/claims.
This is LBC.
Hey, you! Yeah, you! What would you like from your investing app? 6% interest on your ISA, a free share of your choice, or no commission on stocks and ETFs up to €100,000 per month? With XTB, you get all of the above all in one app. The XTB app. Get your free share and start investing with XTB today. XTB, where your money works.
Capital at risk. Investment values can rise or fall. Limited free stock availability. 2% ISA rate boost for 90 days. New clients only. T's and C's apply.
Cancer doesn't care about childhood. It doesn't care what they miss out on or how much you want to protect them. But we do. At Great Ormond Street Hospital Charity, we fund life-saving research, vital family support, and the special things that help seriously ill kids be kids until no childhood is lost to cancer. Join us. Search GOSH Charity.
Turn up your taste buds with Dolmio Intensify pasta sauces.
From mild creamy garlic and black pepper to bold smoky garlic and sun-dried tomato.
Whoa!
And spicy smoked paprika and chili.
Woo!
Try Dolmio Intensify. Pasta sauces with serious flavor. Dolmio, yeah!
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working. Offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
Our pets in a pickle. We're here when it matters most. For fuss-free pet insurance policies as unique as they are, visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
9 minutes to ten the time. Here's Ian in Burton. You want to pick up on this resident doctor's strike, Ian. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Very welcome.
Tom, I'm a teacher, right? But I know the medical profession inside out as well. I've got relatives and friends in there, too. Can I say something to you? You know, you mentioned RPI.
Yes.
I belong to the NASUT as well. And we've been clamouring since 2008 to get our pay restoration linked to RPI.
Yes.
But to little avail.
Yeah.
It depends on where you peg it, though, doesn't it, Tom?
Yeah.
Because those doctors are right. And let me tell you why. Because the pay depreciation has been appalling, and you know this. It's been dreadful since 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and by the way, 4 weeks ago, and you mentioned this on your program, Tom, which group in the public sector, our MPs, they were offered over 100 grand, weren't they?
Mm-hmm.
From about, on average, about 80 grand a year. Mm-hmm. What's my point? My point is, maybe theirs is pegged to RPI. But if you look at their inflation rate increase, it's phenomenal.
I don't think there's this peg to RPI.
Well, look at their inflation rate increase. They've gone from about 79 grand to 100 grand.
Not overnight.
Yes, but look at the extent of their increase,
They've had
Tom.
Pay increases. Ian, I know. I think you're going to be hard-pressed, though, sir, to find people in the public sector who have had pay increases over the last 5 years of 33%, which is what...
But, Tom, they've gone from 80 grand to over 100 grand.
Over a course of a number of years, yeah, absolutely. I'll look into
Tom,
it. I will find the figure of the rate of increase that NP's pay has had over the last few years, and we can compare it to the rate of junior doctors. And if it's higher, then I think MPs are going to have to wear that and explain why. And if it's not, then junior doctors are getting back to where they want to be far quicker.
Well, Tom, on a morality level, they save lives. Mm-hmm. What do MPs do for us as part of our representative democracy? Do these do something as dignified and as saving lives?
Do you want people to be paid better or not?
Yeah, I do. Right. I want doctors to be paid far better as well. I want my profession to be paid and respected and stop being demonised all the time.
I don't think they are demonised, Ian. They're demonised by some, of course. I wouldn't demonise a doctor for the work that they do because we need them. But what I do think is, there is a selective choice here about the amount that needs to be covered by pay increases to mean that when the government offers a 3.5% pay increase this year, along with the other pay increases last year, and inflation is currently at 3%, it takes a bit of a stretch for that doctor's committee to say, well, that doesn't cover rising inflation, I think. Don't you?
Yeah, I understand that point. But look at the magnitude of MP salaries increases. And if we look at ergonomics, the laws of ergonomics, where we compare the value of a job, you compare the value of a surgeon or a doctor with an MP, and where would you reach? You know, I would prefer the Rutger Bregman argument to say that doctors and teachers, I'm biased, of course, do a far more altruistic job in saving lives and me creating the doctors of the future than an MP does.
Yeah, you could apply that. I mean, apply it to footballers. Paid extraordinary sums of money, but that should go to elsewhere. Traders, you know, what do traders really do for the greater good of the blah, 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 blah? They're paid fortunes.
Yes, but it means that, if you address this issue, right, I'd say to that trade union representative of the BMA, you know, let's not talk about pay for the moment, but let's look at the conditions of the job.
Well, they'd want to talk about pay. I don't think you'd get very far with not talking about pay. Ian, appreciate it. Talking of pay, I thank you very much, dear. I have the numbers in front of me. Taking on the same scale, so since 2020, the average cash pay for junior doctors has increased by 33%. For MPs, since 2020, they've gone from 81,932 to, in 2026, 98,599. Cash increase of 16 and a bit. Percentage increase of 20%. So that's still chunky. That's a 20% pay rise for MPs over the last 6 years, but it's a way off 33%. James is in, is it Mega in Monmouthshire? Major?
It's Mega, yes, Mega. Correct.
Hello, James, hello. Your thoughts?
Hi. I just can't believe the chair of the BMA. Right. I mean, I look at it from another perspective. Every single public sector worker took that hit. I don't see why these junior doctors think they're a special case. Look at the armed forces. The armed forces haven't had anywhere near the pay increases that junior doctors have had. And I would say they do just as an important job
right.
as junior doctors.
Isn't that an argument to unionise? Of course, the army can't, but that's an argument to get a union.
No, not at all. Far from it. I mean, you can't have our armed forces in a union.
No,
but they are never talked about in this conversation. Yet, I've just heard about, you know, the gentleman that went on about teachers working these extra hours and not mm-hmm. getting paid. Join the armed forces and see what extra hours you work.
I understand,
and
James,
your pay doesn't change.
So the argument from you is, because certain sectors have not had as much of a pay increase in the public sector than everybody else, no one else should get more than the lowest paid.
I think it has to be balanced across the board. I mean, you can't just have one certain, you know, profession saying we are more deserving than others.
I take the point. I mean, they are put on earth to act in their members, what they see as their members' interests. I think that's their job. And in that sense, they've been relatively successful at it. I just think it would aid their argument massively if they actually put to their members the thing they're saying that their members would reject. James, thank you. Mark's in Oxford. Mark.
How are you doing?
Your daughter's a GP, is that right?
Yeah, she's a GP and I've got a daughter-in-law the same. And I just really wanted to make the point that it appears that they're not really valued in terms of remuneration. And I know all this argument of which job everybody does this, but mm-hmm. if you look at most jobs in the world, you've got to have qualifications to get them, then you've got to pass
yep.
exams to get there. Now, to be a doctor, it's not a bluffers course.
No.
You can't get through. So, and I look at what they get paid compared to other jobs.
Other
professional jobs.
But there are lots of other professional jobs. There are lots of jobs that are paid a lot more. You could come out of university with a bluffer's degree, he says, waving, and go into a very nice job at JP Morgan or whatever and earn oodles more, but you're not paid by the taxpayer.
No, but equally, you could argue that the presenters who work for the BBC are paid by the taxpayer, and all of those pay significantly more than any GP that I know. So where does it end?
Is comparing apples and apples when you're talking about pay from the public sector. That's pretty crucial, isn't it?
It is crucial, but you've got to decide what the balance is. And on the scale from left to right, and I don't wish to decry somebody who sweeps the road right up to a consultant, where does a doctor? They're going to be towards the top end, and they're not.
All right. Mark, I appreciate the call. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you for all of your calls, texts, tweets, emails. Throughout the course of the programme today, that is it from me. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the LBC app, where you can stay up to date with all the latest news, videos and opinion. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Have yourself a very good Easter. I'll see you Tuesday. Coming up at 1, it's Sheila Fogarty. Next, James O'Brien.
Thank you, Tom. The time is approaching 10 o'clock and we find ourselves caught once again between the Scylla and Charybdis of Donald Trump's public pronouncements. On the one hand, I often explain or remind you why they should largely be ignored, because he will contradict himself within nanoseconds. And on the other hand, I constantly remind you that suggesting that you should concentrate on what he does instead of what he says is the last redoubt of sort of sycophantic idiots. You have to somehow plot a course between both positions. And when the President of the United States of America posits the notion of leaving NATO, and people who are cleverer than me take it seriously, we should pay attention.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, the chair of the BMA Resident Doctors Committee has told LBC he will happily resume talks over Easter to try to avoid strike action. The six-day walkout by resident doctors over pay and jobs is due to start next Tuesday. A government deadline to call off the strikes or face losing extra training places has expired. Dr. Jack Fletcher was asked by Tom Swarbrick why the current deal hasn't been put to BMA members.
We are absolutely willing to put offers to our members if we think they're substantial enough, if we think they're credible. That is not a problem, but this offer is not it, and threatening to remove 1,000 jobs is bad for doctors and is bad for patients.
Percentage chance of you seeing Wes Streeting over the course of the Easter holidays?
I will happily meet the government, the Secretary of State, whoever wants to meet with us to try and find a way out of this, but ultimately there has to be an improvement to that offer.
President Trump says the US is on track to complete all of its objectives in the war in Iran very shortly. In a televised address overnight, he said America will hit the country extremely hard over the next 2 to 3 weeks. Since the speech, oil prices have risen by 7% to $107 a barrel. Mr. Trump also had this message for other countries hoping to see the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz.
To those countries that can't get fuel, many of which refuse to get involved in the decapitation of Iran, we had to do it ourselves. I have a suggestion. Number one, buy oil from the United States of America. We have plenty. We have so much. And number two, build up some delayed courage. Should have done it before. Should have done it with us, as we asked. Go to the Strait and just take it. Protect it.
The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, will host a virtual meeting of 35 nations later, focused on reopening the Strait of Hormuz. It's reported Thames Water could come to an agreement with the regulator Ofwat to have any future fines waived until 2030. The firm, which has more than 16 million customers, is grappling with debts of around £20 billion. It would still face penalties from outstanding legal cases and the Environment Agency. New rules to protect people from so-called subscription traps have been announced by the government. Companies will now have to give customers a cooling-off period and make it straightforward to cancel. And NASA's first crewed mission to the moon in more than 50 years has blasted off from Florida. Artemis 2 is due to take the crew further into space than anyone's gone before. The mission won't land on the moon, but will pass its far side, hopefully paving the way for a lunar landing in 2 years' time. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 4 points at 10,360. The pound buys $1.32 and €1.14. LBC weather. A sunny morning for many, but gradually clouding over throughout the day. Heavy rain will develop for Northern Ireland and the west of Scotland by the afternoon. A high of 13 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Breakups, that is a tricky one. That's why EE is the only major provider who'll give you up to £300 to switch. You'll get full fibre, but you'll also get EE's most powerful Wi-Fi 7 as standard. So the whole house can do more like streaming that series, watch your work calls stay crystal clear. Switch to EE today.
Up to £300 credited to your EE account. Verify at ee.co.uk/claims. New BT Group customers only. 62% availability terms apply.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Four minutes after ten is the time. Of all the things that I wish I could do, I was thinking about this the other day. Putting together a Spotify playlist of my favourite house tunes, C-H-O-O-N-S. If you know, you know. Of all the things I wish I could do, I wish I'd been able to DJ. I've been lucky enough to meet some of my heroes over the years, Graham Park, Dave Haslam and others, and if I wish I'd been able to DJ. And I sometimes think that the skills you need to DJ are the same skills you need to sort of hit your junctions and your jingles on time on the radio. It's about having an internal sense of rhythm. And thank you to everybody who noticed that I just made a complete pig's ear of this morning's attempt to sort of straddle the sound effects towards the end of the little 60-second talk-up that I get at the end of Nick and, of course, today Tom's programme. But I don't think anyone's put it better than Javier, who writes, I love you, but do you want to try that intro again, James? And then adds, I'm glad you weren't in charge of the Artemis launch. Which is, I think, a nice place to put the bar, the banter bar, early doors this morning. If you can be funnier than Javier in the course of today's programme, then you run a very real risk of having your contribution read out on the programme. I mean, this is one of those mornings that where I think you have to treat the abnormality with a modicum of normality. Do you know what I mean? I think you agree with me now, if you didn't already, that it is incredibly liberating to simply acknowledge and remember that Donald Trump is a deranged liar. It was a message last week, wasn't it? Was it last week, the fellow who texted in to say, I don't know why you talk about people you don't know. And the idea that anybody is unaware of why what Donald Trump is doing in Iran is of absolutely epic importance to everybody in this country, I think has now disappeared. Some of the stranger messages of 2026 probably suggesting that, he lives rent-free in your head. I can't. I mean, it's a bit like questioning why you're talking about an enormous rock that is being tossed into the pond that you live in. With the subsequent ripple effect. And by rock, I mean something the size of Gibraltar. It's going to capsize your boat. If you live on the water, you're likely to drown. I mean, the idea that you wouldn't be talking about this stuff, I think, has now been consigned to Idiot's Corner forever. In fact, a one-way ticket. No reprieves, no releases. But there are still mornings where you have to park the deranged liar lens. Everything is easier when you remember what he is, and you don't have to treat everything he says in the way that you would any other president who wasn't a deranged liar. But there comes two points. Points come in this madness, in this continuing and unfolding madness. Points come where you have to treat it as if he is a normal US president. There are some... So, I mean, Simon Marks, to be honest with you, made me realise this yesterday. Not for the first time. Simon made me realise with his very calm and clear commentary. And Simon will be presenting Tom Sawbrick's show today. It's the Easter weekend and then Holy Week, which means that there's all sorts of... it's Easter, the end of Holy Week, the Easter weekend, and then... next week, I'm off next week as well, which means World War III will probably start if you're a regular listener to this program. The coincidence of my annual leave with moments of absolutely epic importance isn't funny anymore, is it? I came back once. I actually came back when I had a day off booked after Dominic Cummings spouted all his lies about Barnard Castle. I rang up the boss and said, I hadn't gone anywhere, had I? Because we were all in lockdown. I was in Chiswick. I rang out the boss and said, can I come on tomorrow? I really need to talk about this. Thank goodness you asked. I was worried about phoning you. I didn't think you'd welcome me interrupting your holidays. It's not exactly a holiday, is it? So anyway, I am away next week and I am nowhere near, the studio. I'm not going to tell you where I am because, frankly, I've had a look at the weather forecast and I don't want you to laugh at me. But I am nowhere near the studio and I may actually be, well, not to give too much away, I may be quite difficult to get hold of. I look at next week's events and I find myself wondering how bad can it get. And then I look at yesterday's events and I need to remind myself that sometimes you have to take him seriously. The reason I mentioned Simon Marks is because he was sitting in that chair yesterday, the chair I just pointed at on the radio, which of course you can't see. He was sitting in that chair yesterday and